Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. So O.J. Simpson croaked. I don't know if you heard.
He did. Where were you when you heard the news? Because everybody relived every O.J. moment of their lives yesterday.
So the O.J. Simpson death, of course, demands that we all go back to the 90s and recount his murder trial. And so what do you think the lasting impact, if any, on that O.J. Simpson acquittal was on race relations in America? 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 64636-DA, turnkey.pro text line. I mean, you recall the indelible video that some of you have probably revisited in the last 24 hours, the Oprah show, when Oprah carried the verdict live, and the verdict was read on the screen, and the black women in her audience stood up and cheered, and most of the white women sat down, or, you know, stayed sitting and were like shaking their heads, and Oprah was just sort of staring at the screen without any expression. Yeah, that was sort of an indelible moment, because it sort of was a microcosm of how black and white reacted to the trial. I mean, there's exceptions, of course, but just sort of generally speaking, and this was much of the conversation then.
Well, I remember I was in the newsroom at WJBK in Detroit, and all the black photographers, high five, everyone was like, yeah! And I was sitting there like, two people are dead. What are we celebrating? And one of my guys came up and goes, you know what, Amy? He goes, now black people have been able to do what white rich people have been able to do their whole lives, and that's buy their freedom. It's like, okay.
That's part of the cover story that was offered then and now.
You know, right.
Joy Reid was on, of course, with, I can't wait, it was either Chris Hayes or Rachel Maddow. I can't tell the two apart. Anyway, she explained why they were celebrating then, and maybe they still feel vindicated 30 years later.
The reason black people cheered was not because they were cheering for the idea of getting away with murder. They were cheering the idea that a black man could face the criminal justice system and have all and come at it with equal resources, unheard of.
Right.
O.J. Simpson walked into that courtroom with something no black person normally had. Normally, even just
the best lawyers in America,
the best lawyers in America, who out-lawyered the prosecutors, because even 30 years earlier, just the idea that he might have harmed his wife, he would have been lynched.
Oh, please.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 64636-DA, turnkey.pro text line.
I'm sorry. Did she not know they had a history, those two, of domestic violence? She says stuff like that? I'm sorry.
He had some of the best lawyers, and turns out that prosecutor's office had some of the worst. Just going back to think about the jury how it came to be prosecuted in L.A. rather than had the case been filed in Santa Monica, being prosecuted outside of that urban center. The jury would have been a lot different. Probably the verdict would have been a lot different. That was the fatal, actually, it was the under-discussed, but that was the fatal mistake that prosecutors made in the O.J. Simpson case, is they tried it in L.A., but not that Marsha Clark and Christopher Darden were particularly good lawyers anyway. The jury, in case people forgot, it was 10 women and 2 men, 9 black, 1 Hispanic, 2 white, two college grads, nine high school grads, one without a diploma. Some of the other final facts about that jury, just sort of interesting to go back and think about being tried by a jury of your peers. And also, too, I mean, you can't look at you can't talk about the O.J. Simpson trial and not think about where our criminal justice system is today. Because I think there are some parallels.
Well, and also, too, some of the black jurors even came out after the trial and said they were worried about having another Rodney King riot. Here's one of those black female jurors.
Do you think that they're members of the jury that voted to acquit O.J. because of Rodney King?
Yes.
You do?
Yes.
How many of you think felt that way?
Oh, probably 90% of them.
90%? Did you feel that way?
Yes.
That was payback.
Uh-huh.
You think that's right?
And she kind of shrugs like, well,
yeah, that's not being afraid of another Rodney King riot. It's payback. That was saying we're going to acquit this guy that we know is guilty because of the cops that were acquitted in the Rodney King beating. They're not thinking about the implications of the verdict one way or the other. They're saying this is payback for what happened in the Rodney King case because we're going to let somebody off who's guilty because you let somebody off who's guilty. That's what she's saying.
All right. I'm sorry. That was another juror that was saying that. But that's what that juror felt.
Yeah. And that's exactly where I was going, because now we're in a position where that has been scaled. That attitude. What's the implication of the O.J. Simpson trial? The attitude you just heard from that juror that – it's not limited to the O.J. Simpson trial or jury, but that's just the highest profile case, one of the most high profile cases in American history. And so for that attitude to be prevalent there, now think about that downstream. Think about that over the last 30 years. Think about where we are now, where the justice system is designed to persecute people who are not in power. And the power, the balance of power has changed. So you say, well, yeah, Dan, and when it was when there was institutional racism through things like the Jim Crow law and discrimination inculcated into law, then it was people who weren't in power, black people, for example, who were who did not get equal justice under the law. I agree. Yes, that's true. And now the attitude is to say, so now we're going to do it. And we'll do it along racial lines. And now the new wrinkle, we'll do it along political lines, the lines of political belief. And you think that ends well. And you think that constitutes a payback, to use that juror's word, or to use the word that she agreed with in terms of characterizing her position. So that's what I'm talking. That's where we're at. You know, follow the bouncing ball. And you think continuing to go down this road, whoever's in power gets to punish or benefit their allies, punish their enemies, and benefit their allies. That's what the justice system is for. You did it to some, so we're going to do it to others. Okay. And you're forever going to be in power, so it can never boomerang on you. And you think that's the foundation of a free society. And that's maybe what we should be thinking about with respect to the O.J. trial. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro, answer line 646-36-DA, turnkey.pro, text line. Some other facts about the jury. None regularly read a newspaper, but 8 regularly watched tabloid TV news.
That's helpful.
5 thought it was sometimes appropriate to use force on a family member.
Yeah, boy.
All were Democrats. 5 reported they or another family member had a negative experience with the police. 9 thought that Simpson was 9. 9.
9 out of the 11. Okay.
9 of the 11.
Yes.
Thought that Simpson, OJ, was less likely to be a murderer because he was a professional athlete.
Oh, come on. Nothing to do with it.
The pool, the jury pool, was 40% white, 28% black, 17% Hispanic. The final jury, as I said, was 9 black, 1 Hispanic, 2 white. Man, this thing was wired to blow from the beginning.
And don't forget, Ron Goldman, he went to high school here. It's in Stevenson High School.
Yeah, right.
And graduated in the early 90s. And an innocent by who's just returning her glasses that she left at the, her mom's glasses that were left at the dinner table.
KJP had a message on behalf of the Biden administration for the family of OJ.
I'll say this. Our thoughts are with his families during this difficult time, obviously with his family and loved ones. And I'll say this. I know that they have asked for some privacy. And so we're going to respect that. I'll just leave it there.
Oh, my God. What about Nicole Simpson's family? Her sisters, her beautiful sisters. What about Ron Goldman's dad, who, by the way, Fred... Remember him? He put out a statement. It's no great loss to the world. It's a further reminder of Ron's being gone. That she's sick. Like, who does she have any empathy for anybody?
Why would you even comment? On the passing of O.J. Simpson? I mean, if from the White House.
And after all he did, I know you're right, but even after all that O.J. did do, he had 5 children, 3 with his first wife, 2 with Nicole, and when he died, his kids were with him and his grandchildren.
His families, I know. I heard from KJ. Mm-hmm. NPR, boy, the Uri Berliner essay that we talked about the other day, 25-year senior editor, covers the business desk for NPR, couldn't have been more timely. NPR's headline, breaking news, football great Arenthal James Simpson, known as O.J., has died.
Oh, my God.
That's the top line, you think? football great O.J. has died. Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Gosh, I wonder what they're getting at.
Director David Zucker from Naked Gun. Rest in peace, Norberg. His acting was a lot like his murdering. Excuse me. His acting was a lot like his murdering. He got away with it, but no one believed him. Director of 2 Naked Gun movies.
We couldn't have a conversation about O.J. without a hat tip to the late, great Norm MacDonald, who manned the weekend update desk on SNL.
Dear Lord.
Back when it was funny because of Norm MacDonald, and spent a lot of his comedic capital at O.J.'s expense and at the expense of people who were playing the sort of mindless racial politics with the justice system that were being played.
Remember 12 Angry Men, the classic courtroom drama? Well, the first film about the O.J. Simpson case is in the works. It's entitled 9 Angry Black People, 2 Scared Asians, and a White Guy Who Hasn't Spoken Since Rosa Lopez.
Rosa Lopez, if you have your O.J. Simpson score sheet that you dusted off, she was the O.J.'s maid from El Salvador, who got pressured into testifying by Judge Ito. And she had her life, you know, thrown upside down. She hated all the attention. After she testified, she fled back to El Salvador. She never returned.
Right.
So that's the Rosa Lopez reference, because it's a bit of a deep dig 30 years later.
Listen to podcast of Dan and Amy from the AM 560 mobile app. Download it today at 560theanswer.com/mobile.
Hey, business owners, is your business and money in good hands? Does your bank invest in your success? Hi, Mike Gallagher here, letting you know that when you need a relationship bank, Signature Bank makes commercial banking personal. I love these guys. Not only do they have expansive industry experience, a strong financial track record, but they're also highly capitalized for strategic growth. That's so important. That's why Signature Bank is my bank. They know what it means to grow a business by designing solutions that are right for you and only you. These are real people. They're ready to help. So reach out to my friends at Signature Bank. Make the call today, 773-467-5630. 773-467-5630, or visit them online at signaturebank.bank. That's signaturebank.bank. Your business could be Signature Bank's next success story. Go online, signaturebank.bank, member FDIC, equal housing lender. Signature Bank.
Only the biggest stories, only the biggest guests, and only the biggest opinions. This is AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. The most uninteresting man in the world is interviewed by one of the most irrelevant news outlets in Chicago. Sorry, Amy.
She is, excuse me, are you talking about my sister, Marianne Ahern?
I'm talking about NBC5. Yeah, Marianne Ahern's the...
I love Marianne Ahern.
You can love her all you want. I'm just saying this interview with Rich Gaidis, the outgoing chief of staff for BLM Brandon, was completely without point. I don't know why Gaidis did it. I mean, other than to show that he is a dutiful soldier who will continue to repeat the party line, so that in his new gig at Blue Star Security, he can still have access to city and county and I'm sure state contracts for his new employer. Mm-hmm. But I mean, if your job ostensibly is to provide useful information to your audience, then I don't know what the point of talking to Rich Gaidis is. I mean, I know that's just what they say they're supposed to do, that they do, or that's their objective, but that's not really what they're interested in. That what the D.C., what the Chicago Press Corps is, which is just an outpost of the D.C. Press Corps, their job is to give the appearance of providing useful information, pretend that they're acting as a check on the powers that be rather than as their comm shop, unless, of course, somehow, some way, a non-fellow traveler would get into a position of power. But that's not going to happen in Chicago or Cook County. So they are very secure in being the provider of the agitprop for the political class in Chicago. And that's what Marianne Ahern did in her interview with Rich Gaidis. Get ready to be knocked over with a feather when Rich Gaidis talks migrants.
We can't control what is being sent our way from the border. Today, I think we got 4 buses coming today. We've been averaging about 2 buses a day for the last, couple weeks.
Rich Gaidis on Brandon Johnson's weaknesses. Are you at the place now where you can talk about any weaknesses, areas of improvement that have been identified for this administration?
It comes down to communication. And I think that whatever the message is, wherever it's coming from, you have to communicate and be able to push your message across so that it's understood, it's explainable. And, let people know you're seeing both sides.
A lifelong Chicagoan.
Blah, blah, blah.
Okay. Well, sometimes, Dan, you get the interview, but you don't get the goods. So then you can't turn down the interview once you...
You can't?
He wasn't spilling the beans. He wasn't saying what the real reason was, which I believe was the spot shooter finally going away. That was his last straw. Because he was fighting with the assistant chief of staff.
Yeah. Yeah, he wasn't pressed. Because if he was pressed, you know what you'd have? What? You'd have a portion of the interview dedicated to pressing him when he says things like, you can't control what comes our way. Really? Do you think if Chicago is a sanctuary jurisdiction that Greg Abbott would be sending migrants to Chicago? Or would he choose some other sanctuary jurisdiction to make his point? Oh, but that follow-up question wasn't in the interview because it wasn't asked. Rich Gaidis on crime.
Lifelong Chicagoan.
That hurts when you hear stuff like that, right? I mean, as lifelong Chicagoans, you were very proud, right? Chicago, in general, public safety-wise, we're trending better than we have over the last couple of years.
Oh, wow. That is, man.
The same pablum, same BS bull jive line.
I never understood it. What these moments of clarity? Thank you, Rich Gaidis. Now, look, I don't expect a functionary like him to offer anything particularly interesting, but then don't do the interview and make an ass of yourself. demonstrate to the entire city how unremarkable you are. All of this buildup. Rich Gaitis, we've got a steady hand on the till. Rich Gaitis is a longtime professional. He's served several mayors. He's been in this position, in that position, in this position, with that mayor, and so on. So he's going to ensure nothing goes awry when it comes to Lollapalooza, when it comes to NASCAR, when it comes to the DNC. Your gimme dat summer is in the able hands of lifelong Chicagoan Rich Gaitis.
Okay,
I mean, give me a break with this carnival barking nonsense.
I watched it too and went, what? Why even bother? I learned nothing.
312-642-5600, turnkey.proanswerline, 646-36-DA, turnkey.pro text line.
But I still love Marionette. At least you got the interview. But then why go with it?
Have anything against Rich because I don't know him. But, I mean, the best part was when her little segment was over and they threw it back to the news desk. Alice Rosati, Rich Gaitis, he served the city well.
I know. I'm like, oh, honey.
What are you talking about?
Oh, my God. Please stop.
You don't know anything about just
read the
teleprompter. You don't know anything about anything, much less city government. Maybe Rich Gaitis is an effective administrator, a competent guy, a straight shooter. Maybe he's all those things. I don't know. But over his three years, I mean, the city is disintegrated. And I'm not putting this at his doorstep, but he served the city well. How? Hey, Allison Rosati, tell us more about Rich Gaitis's tenure in this post and that post for this mayor and that mayor and how he served the city so well. These people just repeat can't. And the drones in Chicago just gobble it up. Lifelong Chicago. Well, we're proud Chicagoans of this city that works. And we work hard and we play hard. And da-da-da-da-da. I mean, you literally should just have Yiddish spoken. You could have 30 minutes of Yiddish where people didn't understand a word he said, but just the inflection and the smiles and the blah, 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 blah. You could just do a little dance number for 30 minutes on these network affiliate newscasts. And you'd get the same reaction from the Chicago viewers. I like that that guy on CBS at the 6. I like that that lady at 10 o'clock on the ABC. What a joke. What an embarrassment. Honestly. Oh, meanwhile, in actual news, yes, done by fake news outlets like the ones that Dan Proft, right-wing slime merchant, is associated with.
You know, the guy who put up the Scream video? Somebody asked me one too, like, do you work with that guy? I said, what guy? Who put up the Scream ad? I'm like, yeah, I do.
You should have said.
When I saw I will never forget, when I saw it, I was at my liberal friend's house. We're all watching football. It was in the fall, and it came on, and the room got quiet. And then they're like, I can't believe that's awful. And I said, no, that's the world we live in. That's excellent. That is a graphic reminder to everybody what it's really like to live in Chicago. Good for him.
And then Allison Rosati said, that's the work product of a right-wing slime merchant, Dan Proft, who has not served the city well.
No, she didn't say that.
I'm just making it
up. But they did all try to yank.
Of course.
Oh, they did yank it, though. Channel 9 was first, right?
They did, absolutely. They got calls. People, your neighbors were upset. They don't want to live in reality. They want to live in the world where Allison Rosati lives.
You're doing a really bad Allison Rosati.
It's the same voice. It doesn't male, female. It's all the Chuck Gowdy I-team. I mean, it's the same. I have one impersonation
now
for network affiliate news. Chuck Gowdy and the I-team investigating. Okay. Meanwhile, in actual news,
yes, sir.
You know, we were talking about Dexter Reed because of the police-involved shooting in which he was killed after he opened fire on police.
11 rounds. But don't tell any, it's 11, it's 96. Well, my God.
Dexter Reed, he had some sort of transportation business. And I say some sort of transportation business.
What was he transporting?
Because we don't know. We don't know. But what we do know is he got $20,832 from the Paycheck Protection Program during COVID for a transportation business. his business all other support activities for transportation, quote, from the SBA. This is SBA data.
Oh, my God.
Remember, just a little background, arrested in July of last year for aggravated unlawful use of a weapon.
It was loaded, too, I found out.
Arrested 3 months earlier last year, retail theft from the Zara clothing store. And then, of course, the fateful day where he decided to open fire on police after a lawful stop, as far as we know. But that whole PPP loan scam, too, in terms of layering in COVID and all of the fraud. You know, I mean, Merrick Garland put out this big press release. We have a Department of Justice. He also sounds like Allison Rosati or Chuck Audi in the I-team. We have interdicted, rooted out $1.4 billion in COVID fraud. Oh, my gosh, $1.4 billion. It's in the hundreds and hundreds of billions. Hundreds and hundreds of billions. And they're celebrating $1.4 billion of low-hanging fruit. I mean, the scams that were run. Scam at the federal government level, scam at the state and local government levels, scam at the private citizen level. This is the same thing as where we were talking about with payback. It's just we run scams to punish our political enemies and benefit our political friends. And I mean, to the extent some of our political enemies benefit, you know, we have to keep up appearances with something like something as large as the payroll protection program, which, again, I was supportive of in theory because it was a government taking. The problem was I was opposed to the government taking in the first place in terms of the lockdowns. That's the, you know, the context of this. That's the textual response to COVID lockdowns and to all of this resultant and easily anticipated theft. But I just note Dexter Reed benefited from the PPP program. He supposedly had a transportation business. It's funny that nobody's brought that up, that he was an entrepreneur with the transportation business. Played basketball at Westinghouse. He played basketball at Morton College. He's an athlete. That was a decade ago or a little less. And he got $20,000 from the federal government for his transportation business. Why didn't anybody talk about him being an entrepreneur? Being a job creator.
Well, they said that he was looking, his family told their attorney that he was looking to open up a clothing line or become a sports broadcaster.
No, but what was he doing now?
Right. That's the thing.
Well, no, that's not the thing. He had a transportation business he got federal grants essentially for. So what was that transportation business? Why didn't anybody bring it up? David Winneka, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Hey, good morning, guys. Dan, you just accidentally stumbled along. This guy's tagline should be this guy. Who are you voting for, man? I'm voting Gaddis. He's a straight shooter. Rich guy is a straight shooter.
Yeah.
Crime is actually how I was a Democrat prior, and even when Trump was Trump in power, and I was a little bit moron, and I came home one night. It was after I was driving Uber at the time, and I'd been robbed that day on my phone. I remember Lightfoot coming on and just, I turned down a fascist Trump's plea for the National Guard. What a fascist. F you, Trump, da, da, da. And meanwhile, she's like, we're not a violent city at all, and blah, blah, blah. And, a few weeks later, finally, they allowed Trump's National Guards to come in. I remember how safe I felt seeing a soldier on every corner. Just, and these guys are babies, these guys and girls, they were just babies. And I thought, my God, this is what it's come down to. But going back to Lightfoot, just, my last point here, the one most unbelievable thing that she did do that nobody ever in the world could have taken upon themselves to do this, she found the only human being that was uglier than her to take as partner. Have a great day, guys.
Thanks for the call, David. I hope things are still going well with that girlfriend. David from Winneka, he told us yesterday he dates outside of his race. I don't know if you knew that. Yeah, and his girlfriend, apparently, they've already gotten close enough where he knows she makes like $150,000. So,
isn't she a liberal?
I don't know if she's a liberal on everything, but I think he recounted how they had a disagreement. It was a racial political issue. But anyway. Rich Gaitis, just since he brought up crime, again, Rich Gaitis, who is the E.F. Hutton of public policy. Shh. Rich Gaitis is about to talk about public safety. Quiet!
That hurts when you hear stuff like that, right? I mean, as lifelong Chicagoans, you know, you were very proud, right? Chicago, in general, public safety-wise, we're trending better than we have over the last couple of years.
Rich Gaitis, he served the city well. Fare thee well, Lord Gaitis. Dan and Amy, Chicago's Morning Answer.
Listen to podcast of Dan and Amy from the AM 560 mobile app. Download it today at 560theanswer.com/mobile.
Hey, business owners, is your business and money in good hands? Does your bank invest in your success? Hi, Mike Gallagher here, letting you know that when you need a relationship bank, Signature Bank makes commercial banking personal. I love these guys. Not only do they have expansive industry experience, a strong financial track record, but they're also highly capitalized for strategic growth. That's so important. That's why Signature Bank is my bank. They know what it means to grow a business by designing solutions that are right for you and only you. These are real people. They're ready to help. So reach out to my friends at Signature Bank. Make the call today. 773-467-5630. Or visit them online at signaturebank.bank. That's signaturebank.bank. Your business could be Signature Bank's next success story. Go online, signaturebank.bank, member FDIC, equal housing lender. Signature Bank.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. We've talked about these policies in K-12 government school systems before, but let's revisit. I'm talking about zero tolerance policies. The sort of stories that you've heard, the grade school boy who makes a gun with his sandwich. Index finger and his thumb, or out of a sandwich, and points it at somebody, you know, plays bang bang with his index finger and thumb and gets suspended or expelled. Zero tolerance for violence. This movement that started a while back, the last decade and a half, I'd say. We have policies and procedures. We have this manual. We have a zero tolerance policy. Look, it's right here in the student handbook. What we don't have are adults in charge of schools that have the ability to use their brains and make intelligent judgment calls rooted in common sense. And so thus you have these excesses where, of course, you want a safe environment for kids in school. But the kid who goes bang, bang with his index finger is not a public safety threat. And it should not be one strike and you're expelled, which there are stories like that. There are mm-hmm. cases where that's occurred. So here we go again. This is not quite that. But based on her characterization of it, it sounds like a good example of being the bad example when it comes to zero tolerance policies. And I'm talking about Lower Richland High School in South Carolina. Sierra Patterson is a senior there. She just recently addressed the school board to discuss her plight. Take a listen.
Good evening. My name is Sierra Patterson. I'm a 17-year-old girl who attends Lower Richland High School. I'm a senior this year. I have 25 and a half credits with a 3.9 unweighted GPA. I'm also an IB and honor student. I have done cheer for Lower Richland since I was 13 years old on varsity every year. I'm enlisted in the SC National Guard with the MOS of 31 Bravo, which is a military police officer. And I will be attending basic training in AIT this summer after graduation. Then in spring 2025, I will be attending Winston-Salem University, majoring in criminal justice and a minor in forensic psychology to become a homicide detective. I have already been accepted into Winston-Salem as well. While attending Laura Richland High School, I haven't had any referrals nor disciplinary actions. On January 22nd, as I was trying to break up an altercation due to no admin nor security being present, I was then attacked by a girl and we began to have a physical altercation. Then I was attacked by her friend as well, which I have video evidence of. This caused me to be referred to the hearing board and then to Olympia Learning Center because of the violation of Level 3, 3.17, major disruption of the education environment. At Olympia, they only have 2 out of my 7 classes, which are personal finance and economics. I then put in an appeal and waited 3 weeks, and then to where I went to my appeal, and I was sent to serve at Homebound Services last week when I got this information. But they didn't have my classes on Edgenuity, so then they contacted my base school, which is Laura Richland, and they said they would try to get my classes online through Schoology. And I was informed of that information today. I stand before you to state I have missed almost 2 months of my education due to this altercation, and I'm the only senior in this situation. They are all receiving the education needed for them to complete their grade, but I am not receiving none of mine in my senior year, and I'm the senior who is graduating this year. These are classes I need to graduate that aren't available. I have reached out multiple times to get work from my base school, but didn't receive anything, and I was removed from power school, so my teachers were unable to grade me and it was putting me more behind. I am not failing, and I know I'll be able to catch up with the time I have left. I'll do a behavior contract or whatever is needed for me to go back to school. I've paid my senior dues for graduation. I paid for my prom dress already as well. I've worked so hard to be in the top 30% of my class. Kept A's and B's every quarter to make sure I continue to excel in my honor and IB courses. I worked so hard for my IB certification. I apologize for my negligence of the violations I was involved in, and I wish it never happened. I wish I could go back and change the whole situation. My education, life, and career are now all on the line and being affected. I don't have time for summer school due to me leaving for basic training and AIT. I didn't put in another appeal because I don't have that much time left, and I really wanted to be heard as soon as possible. Graduation is in 2 months and 3 weeks.
Parliamentarian, let her continue. Finish, darling.
Graduation is in 2 months and 3 weeks, and prom is in 1 month and 3 weeks. I really hope to attend both. I just want to go back to school to catch up. I'm sorry. I just want to go back to school to catch up back in my classes, which I know I am capable of doing, and walk at my graduation that I have worked so very hard for. Oh, God bless your hearts for what may happen next. Thank you for your time, and thank you for listening to me. Again, God bless you all. Have a great rest of your evening. Thank you.
Right. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. 646-36-DA, turnkey.pro text line. What do you say? Rules are rules. The system is the system. What do you tell Sierra Patterson? First of all, let me just say, and this doesn't just go for the individual at Lower Richland High School, but every unit of government. If you don't get rid of people interrupting people when they're speaking with 30 seconds and your time is up, then I am going to organize a posse and just target those people. For the rest of their lives. Shut up while people are talking. This little girl is a young woman. She's not a little girl. A young woman is pouring out her 30 sec. I got A's. 30 seconds. Shut your mouth and let her finish. If she takes 3 minutes and 30 seconds, so be it.
Well, it just proves that they're not listening to her. I mean, one of the guys is who said, you know, darling, you let her finish. But that guy told her to shut up or like you have 10 seconds.
I'm so sick of listening to that 30 second business. Your time is up. Mic's being cut off. Who the hell do you think you are in these school boards and these local units of government? That's just an aside. But I just had to get that off my chest. It is so annoying. And it's just wildly insulting, particularly in the context of that impassioned plea from that young lady. So that's number one. Number two, why does Sierra Patterson, why is she at a school board meeting during public comment having to address this situation so she can get some appropriate response from her school district, her high school. And I think mom was with her, too, because there was a lady that walked away from the podium with her. Well, why do they have to go to the school board, which meets, what, once or twice a month in most places? Mm-hmm. And explain everything that's happened over the last 3 months from January when this incident occurred to the school board to say, we need you to intervene here. So it's really interesting, too, the enlightened school board and administrators that come together to write and impose these zero tolerance policies. But don't worry, because, you know, that we're still going to make sure they have access to their education, because we've got, you know, what you heard her say, we've got, you get outsourced to this place and you get outsourced to that place. And then, the devil's in the details when it comes to implementation. We have this grand scheme and we memorialize in our policies and procedures, but on the implementation side of it, we fell down a little bit. Gosh, what a surprise. Why is she at the school board? The same adults, so committed, educators, Dr. This and Mr. and Mrs. That. Yeah.
Begging them to take it zero back, tolerance back to for school.
Zero tolerance for something. And by the way, based on what she said and how she said it and what she's done and what she's planning on doing with college and criminal justice and wanting to be a homicide detective, I'm giving her the benefit of the doubt that her characterization of that fight is accurate. That's my first point. I'm giving her the benefit of the doubt. So now you prove, whoever wants to put this girl out of school, you prove to me that she's not telling the truth. And if she is telling the truth that she tried to break up a fight and then she defended herself, then what the hell are we talking about? And why does it take 90 days to get to the bottom of this?
She has a 3.9 GPA.
Unweighted,
right.
Yeah. So, it's, you know, with the weighting that's done to these government schools, it's going to be probably 5.0.
Well, not being able to graduate. I mean, the government school should be open to her. She was a hero in this. She started to break up a fight.
This is the point of this is illustrating the government schools and probably a lot of private schools that operate very similarly in terms of the culture. This is coming at it from another angle. We come at it from the angle of incompetence, and they're not teaching kids how to read and write clearly. And they're what the unions are doing and the politics of it all and wiring school boards and pushing all this cultural Marxism. Here's a kid who, based on what she says her record is, and I believe it based on how composed and thoughtful and articulate she was at the podium, that whether that's a good school or not, she's getting it done. I don't know if it's with a lot of help or on her own, whatever. She's clearly getting it done. And here again, the high-achieving student who's doing everything right, she's the one that falls prey to these mindless policies where no adults are in charge that have functioning, that firing synapses and functioning gray matter where they can make judgment calls, or there's an intersection point so that you can get to an adult who has the authority to intercede to stop this from going on for 3 months. That's another aspect of K-12 education in America that isn't talked about enough, which is why, unfortunately, Sierra Patterson has to provide an example of the sorts of things that are happening to good students like her. Sickening.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 64636, type in DA, then a quick comment. Dan and Amy, please tell me they got this poor girl back into class.
I don't know yet. That plea at the school board meeting happened last week.
It's so stupid. I mean, just...
Yeah, they'll get around to it. Hey, when she's 24, and I mean, no matter what happens to her, I have confidence just that she's going to make it, because she's just one of those people that sounds determined and focused and regimented, and good for her. But they're going to come back when she's... Sierra, you know, it turns out you were right. Sorry about that.
We'll mail you your diploma. I mean, she's already been accepted to college. She's never been in trouble before. This is so stupid. It just reminds me of the whole COVID thing when the big government, they put a policy in place and no one exercises common sense after that. There's no exception to any rule.
Len, Highland Park.
She's so far above those people that are ostracizing her.
I agree.
That young lady ain't got nothing to worry about. She'll find her way, and she'll wind up being even farther above to those. I mean, that was so well written and just so well articulated, and it's amazing, the BS.
Thanks for the call, then.
She wants to go back to school. You have a girl who's begging to get back into a government-run school.
She wants to go to prom.
She wants to go to graduation.
She's a threat to the school safety. Right? Because otherwise, why would the punishment be what it was? That's what they must believe. So do you believe that? That's what I would say. If I was dad, first of all, I could not have the ability to be as respectful as she is. So she's also more mature than me. I would just not have the ability to be that respectful. So here's what you're saying. You're saying that my daughter, I'll play the role of her dad. You're saying my daughter is a threat to public safety. Is that what you're saying? It's a school safety. The kids are afraid of her. Is that what you're saying? This isn't. Yeah. By the way, I'm going to use my 3 minutes. And then I'm going to step away from the podium, and then I'm going to stand in front of each one of you until you answer the question. And until you get off your fat derrieres and get my daughter reinstituted in school right now, call the superintendent, pull him away from, you know, Chili's or wherever he's having his dinner, and get his ass over here and whoever else's asses you need over here, because this ends tonight. And you can take me out with police officers or whatever, and then I'm coming back with all my other dad friends, and we'll be at your houses, and we'll be saying the same thing. We're not going away until you answer the question, and then you reanswer. I mean, honestly, is that what you want this to come to?
Yeah.
Because no.
Text message: with this culture and DEI, you would think zero tolerance policies would be gone.
Well, you know how that, it's true. And she is a young black girl. But yeah, right. I mean, a DEI runs into, you know, other sort of mindlessness, I suppose. But I mean, with respect to zero tolerance policies, you know, there is definitely some latitude there, because zero tolerance also runs into, before DEI, the alternative dispute resolution, like was so ably practiced at Parkland when they didn't get that shooter out of the school a long time after they should have. Remember that? Mm-hmm. And where did that principle come from? Chicago. So we want to end the on the one hand, we want to end the school to prison pipeline. This is their rap. On the other hand, everybody's oppressed, and so they're not responsible for their actions. And then on the other hand, we have a zero tolerance policy. So if you try and break up a fight and we get the facts wrong, then you're out of school. I mean, right. Do not look for intellectual consistency from this crowd, because they're feeling their way through lives. They're sentimental barbarians with an emphasis on barbarian. Don in Orland Park.
Good morning, you guys. Love your show. Imagine if we were this tough on actual criminals that used actual guns. You can shoot somebody and they arrest you, and they'll let you out 3 hours later to get on with your life. This is absolutely ridiculous.
Thanks, Don. Ron and Carol Stream.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. I was just curious. So, you know, I'm taking what she said on face value that, you know, she had video evidence, and that she hadn't stepped in to stop that fight. What if one of the other, you know, people involved had their head bashed to the ground, like the girl a few weeks ago in Missouri? Then what?
Yeah, right. Yeah. Thanks for the call, Ron.
You see the consequences of some of these fights.
Oh, how about Lyons Township and Heaven Washington? Wasn't that her name?
Yeah, I found out she does not go to school there anymore, and they did settle with the family of the victim.
Yeah, and did Western Springs police arrest her?
No.
Right. Was that a criminal act?
Oh yeah, if she did that outside of school, she'd be arrested.
And so what's on her permanent record? Was she just allowed to
transfer to an alternative high school?
Can she only go to an alternative school with kids' behavior problems, or did she choose one?
Is that she's at an alternative high school for troubled teens, and she's going to remain there, and she's not going to be let back into LT.
Yeah, but that was, you know, but that was a wall of silence. You remember the wall of silence from the school. I mean, I know you know, but I'm just saying, reminding people, Lyons Township High School, Western Springs Police. Mm-hmm. So, you know, like I said, the zero tolerance policy, sometimes we enforce it. Sometimes we don't. Sometimes we're asleep at the switch. Sometimes we're not. Sometimes we have friends we need to protect. Sometimes we have enemies we need to punish. Joe in Naperville.
Yeah. What everybody needs to realize is that when you send a certified receipt letter to whoever in charge, the superintendent or all the school board members, is that if somebody signs for it, that's legal proof that the person had received it. So my recommendation, anybody in these situations are kind of backs against the wall, is send a certified letter stating everything and threatening legal action, because once somebody signs for it, they have legal proof they have it. And if they don't do anything about it, then you have all the rights to hold them responsible civilly.
Yeah. Well, I'm to the point. I mean, that's very good legal advice, Joe. I'm to the point. I would be to the point here. I'm to the point as an uninterested third party who lives, you know, states away from Sierra Patterson. I'll take that letter demanding a response from the superintendent, and I'll pound it with a nail on his front door like Martin Luther. And then I'm going to sit on his porch swing until he comes out. That's where I'm at. I mean, if we're not going to protect people doing everything right, we don't do it. We don't do it in the adult world. People who play by the rules. You know, this is my mantra. We don't do it with respect to our government at any level. The least we can do is try and do it with respect to kids. So maybe they can change what America looks like when they get into positions of power like young Sierra. At least we can protect people doing everything right. So say we protect every. We got all kinds of programs, and we want to do everything for everybody who's done everything wrong, in spite of having many chances. And Sierra Patterson falls through the cracks. Bull jive. The hell with that. Going on to South Carolina right now. Stop and play Chichesse with my friend who's a member there.
Yeah.
While I'm at it. Yeah. Get some golf in. Mary Beth, Mount Greenwood.
Hey, Dan and Amy, I think Sierra had it all wrong. What she really should have done was handed the victims one of those cards like they're advocating in California that said, hey, I got your back. Then all the problems would have stopped and all the violence towards the victim would have ended.
Right.
She didn't hand them the card.
Right.
Thank you guys. Love your show.
Thank you. You need the bystander intervention card. Right. It looks like you're being beaten up in the hallway. Would you like some assistance? Excuse me while I hand this card out. Yeah, this is the Bay Area Transit bystander intervention cards, I think they're called. Yeah, bring those to the schools. Good idea. Mm-hmm. I'll tell you who's going to need some of those intervention cards. Ooh. Those school board members.
Yeah.
Chris in Carey, I should say.
Hey, good morning. So whatever happened to, like, we know it when we see it. And I'm not giving the school board a pass, but oftentimes principals don't want to escalate. They don't want to pass the problems on to the admin because the principal gets in trouble. The admin doesn't want to alert the school board because they get in trouble. I'm not giving them a pass again. But we had a situation in my wife's school, and these stupid handbooks that these principals put out and admin puts out, they had a student who stood up behind the teacher when she bent over to help another student, making groaning noises and thrusting his hips at her and grabbing his crotch, okay. A fifth grader. So you know what they did? Took to the principal's office. Well, that's not in our handbook. That is our action. So nothing can be done. Mm-hmm. What happens to we know it when we see it? Come on. Admin's afraid of the board oftentimes. So if the board doesn't know about it, and the parents don't write letters, oftentimes they're just completely naive to the situation.
Thanks for the call, Chris. The problem is, though, I mean, as I recall, school boards get in reports from the administration on disciplinary action when there's the potential for suspension, expulsion. And I would think that in situations like this where you're going to have a kid pulled out of the school and have to have some sort of alternative third-party environment, that the board would be apprised of that. So I find it difficult to believe that the board didn't know, or if they didn't for some reason, that they don't take an action to know going on a go-forward basis. But I know you're not giving them a pass either. But that's normally how it's done when you're talking about a school's decision to remove a student from the school for disciplinary reasons, even for a short period of time, because, of course, there's legal exposure there, and the board needs to be apprised of that as fiduciaries.
Listen to podcasts of Dan and Amy from the AM 560 mobile app. Download it today at 560theanswer.com/mobile. If you're looking for the latest news, insight into what it means, and the sharpest opinion, there's only one station in Chicago where you can turn, and it's this one. We're AM 560, The Answer.
It was revealed today that O.J. Simpson told police that Nicole Brown Simpson used to beat him up. He also claimed that she and Ron Goldman killed him.
The great Norm MacDonald has weekend update O.J. Simpson jokes, which were pretty aggressive for the time, and good for him. Norm MacDonald, the late, great Norm MacDonald, will be interspersing some of his OJ observations all morning. We'll get back to a discussion about that, maybe open mic Friday. Yeah. But anyway.
Because you know what? OJ didn't kill anybody, Dan, but you did. You know why? Because you're not vaccinated.
Remember that?
He was a big vaxxer.
Of course, right. And we always appreciated OJ Simpson's public service announcements.
Uh-huh.
But we need to get to this story that you've been referencing this morning. Do we have a House of Horrors at the Greater Lawndale School for Social Justice, ironically enough?
Yeah, Little Village High School. The Dean of Students, Brian Crowder, according to police and according to the victim's attorneys, he was molesting, raping, grooming a 15-year-old girl. He did it for 3 years. And she came forward because they filed a lawsuit against him. And her story is just heartbreaking.
I was just kind of going by what he was telling me and just kind of doing what I was told to do by him.
Brian Crowder got her pregnant twice. Coerced her into having an abortion. Pretended to be her parent.
Her stepfather.
At the abortion clinics. Uh-huh. And they believed her, didn't even ask any questions. Like, oh, this is your teacher at Little Village High School?
Well, first of all, right. So that was back when you had to notify a parent. When that's no longer the case, thanks to Jelly Belly Pritzker. So the great news for the pro-abortion crowd, that for the next predator like this Brian Crowder, who, by the way, has been charged with a felony count of criminal sexual assault. So alleged sexual predator. The next alleged sexual predator that preys on a young girl like this situation, or many young girls, because it sounds like there are others. Don't have to, and then, you know, get someone pregnant and then takes them to an abortion mill. He just drop her off and no questions asked by Planned Parenthood or one of the other operators of those mills. Yeah, thanks to Jelly Belly Pritzker and all you pro-abortionists in the suburbs.
But her rapist was with her when she got an abortion and they just let it slide because he just lied.
Because he said he was a stepfather.
Yeah. And
what do you think? And just one more point on this, because it shouldn't go unremarked upon. And do you think those intake people at the Planned Parenthood mills, you think they're really trying to sleuth these things out even if they have suspicions? Your name, her name, what the vibe is, the relationship there, checking anybody out, getting IDs, representing your stepfather. Oh, really? Well, let me get your ID, put it part of the record for this case. And so you think they're doing anything like that? No, they're not.
Heck no.
Of course they're not.
Yeah, here's her attorney.
She was abused by a dean. Who was in charge of disciplining students and keeping students safe at that school. He impregnated her twice. He coerced her into two abortions.
And what makes me sick, because I met some teachers from Little Village about a month ago. We ended up at the same place, and we were talking about him. And they know that there's other victims out there. He was relieved of his duties in 2022. But He's not in jail, Dan. And
well, he's charged.
He's charged, but not in jail. And also, he's still getting paid. And he's going to get paid until this goes to trial. So he's been home for a few years, still getting paid. And he raped her. He raped her during class. He raped her. And the worst part is she told a teacher what he was doing to her.
Even though I did ask her not to say anything, I feel like she should have. You know, it was her job to do so.
Well, it was her job to do so,
yeah.
Like under the law.
Mandated reporters.
Yeah.
And she didn't. It just makes me so sick. So I just hope that this story will wake parents up about CPS and what teachers are doing. Some teachers, not all teachers, and I know I love some of the teachers that my kids have had.
Well, obviously,
CPS.
Not
been
all
wonderful.
Teachers. Obviously not all teachers. Just like it wasn't all priests, but
right.
that didn't stop the mob from assembling with their torches and pitchforks. Again, to do the Catholic Church comparison, no defending the Catholic Church. The Catholic Church invited these predators in, and they shuffled them around. There was a reckoning due the Catholic Church for their awful, awful judgment calls, for essentially being accomplices to the predation that occurred under their watch. Even if they turned their eyes, it's still under their watch. So that's not, I'm not, this is not absolving anybody. It's saying if you're serious about the issue, then yes, Catholic Church, but why no CPS and other institutions that somehow we're not supposed to pay as much attention to, despite cases like this, young women coming forward, reports from the Inspector General's office, confirmation from the City Corp Council's office, and really not much coverage and certainly not much reaction from this very dutiful and docile electorate in Chicago that, I would say, and this may be a bit aggressive, but I'm going to say it anyway,
yeah,
that the electorate writ large also accomplices to this sexual predation on young people in CPS. If you don't pay attention and you don't want to pay attention, and you don't want to ask any questions, and you take this oath of silence, despite your mandatory reporting requirements, if you're inside the system, whether you're ever held legally responsible, you're morally responsible. And I think the electorate is morally responsible for what happens in CPS, just as those individuals in the church, men of the cloth or lay people, who knew what was going on and turned a blind eye, they're at minimum morally responsible for what happened in the church.
This teacher gets fired. I mean, she was 15 years old, and she got pregnant. She told a teacher, and the teacher did nothing. And then she got abused for 2 more years. Now she's coming forward because she wants the other girls that she believes were molested by this former dean to come forward.
I just want to help any young girl out there that's maybe going through this to know that it's not okay.
Again, we know that this is a lot more prevalent than people want to admit. I mean, the Shake Shaft report, which we've mentioned almost every time this topic has come up, that was done 25 years ago, essentially estimating 10%, around 10% of sexual assaults in 10% of students in government schools around the country are victims of sexual assaults inside the school. That's about 5 million kids. That report was revisited a few years ago, and they upped the percentage, the guesstimate, if you will. So it's a problem that is much bigger than, at least according to the research. And when you get reports like out of CPS, it seems to substantiate that the research is directionally correct. It's hard to zero in on a precise number, but you have a basic range. And I don't think it's generating the response from the public that those sorts of numbers demand. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro, answer line. And, this happens. This New Hampshire Youth Detention Center that's becoming a national story. New Hampshire Youth Detention Center treat a teen like sex slave, punching bag, lawyer alleges. this is, you know, the foster care system. I mean, it's a whole nother, you know, a whole nother area where abuse is
prevalent,
a real and sustained problem. Yes, exactly.
People do it for the money. I met so many horrible foster parents that just are like, oh, you can get this for that. And then if there's a scuff on the wall, you can get $200 for that. And they were just in it for the money. It was sick.
Workers at New Hampshire's Youth Detention Center treated a teenage boy like a sex slave and punching bag. And the state itself laid the groundwork for the abuse. An attorney argued Tuesday as the first of more than 1,000 lawsuits alleging similar horrors went to trial. 1,000. So, you know, anywhere where there are kids and adults, number one, the screening to be an adult in charge of kids needs to be rigorous, more rigorous than it is currently. I'm talking about the Boy Scouts of America. I'm talking about the Catholic Church. I'm talking about school systems. I'm talking about detention centers. I'm talking about foster care. And number two, you don't play politics with your hiring. In terms of checking boxes and spare me your LGBTQIA two-spirit plus nonsense. We need people that are in the business of child care, child rehabilitation, if it's in a detention center type setting, discipline, education. And again, most of the people in the systems obviously are. But when you're talking about numbers on the order of 5 to 7, 8 million kids nationwide, I should say, in the K through 12 school systems. You're talking about what went on in the Catholic Church. You're talking about what we know is going on in CPS. At least we have some indication from these inspector general reports. Then you're not doing as much as you could. And by the way, the Catholic Church was the bad example on allowing this sort of abuse to occur. But it's been a good example in terms of all of the safeguards that have been put in place subsequently to prevent this in the future. You still have to make personnel decisions. You still have to make judgment calls. But there's a lot more traps for anybody who has designs on exploiting children that catch those people in the Catholic Church because of the oversight, the training protocols, and so on and so forth. So maybe CPS ought to take a look at the Catholic Church. Who wants to write that story? Jordan in Antioch, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Good morning. I sent it in to the chat line, or the text line. I don't know if they come through, but the YouTube commercial for Ms. Burke, you know, your leading Democrat candidate for the Cook County State's Attorney, Ms. Burke, who fearlessly and boldly took on the Catholic Church to protect our community's children. I took on the Catholic Church. I expect somebody to take that ad and put it right between her eyes and say, where are you on this? Where are you on a claim of a teacher or an administrator raping and impregnating a minor and then taking her for abortion? Where are you on the rest of these? I can tell where she's going to be. She is going to be so far off and in the distance and separating herself from this because I guarantee you she probably knows 20 of them that are involved in it.
Well, thanks for the call, Jordan. Well, it's a good point you raised to the extent that the Catholic Church is fair game to attack. And, you know, Cardinal Supich is not going to kick up any dust over it as much of the part of the political power establishment. He is the anti-Catholic. The bigoted Catholic power establishment in this state. He's not going to kick up any dust. But you're right. Eileen O'Neill, O'Malley, O'Shea, Madigan, O'Connor, Walsh, Boyle, Kelly, Byrne, Cullerton, Burke, the Democrat socialist nominee for Cook County State's Attorney. For all you out there with the, oh, at least she provides some hope. Oh, she has to play politics, but then she's going to be a hero. Oh, she's going to do this and she's going to do that. It's not going to be, you know, Irish Kim Fox. Yeah, okay. I don't know her, so I can only go by watching her and listening to her. And what is every indication with every utterance we hear from her? Exactly what Jordan from Antioch said. Dan and Amy, Chicago's Morning Answer.
There's only one radio show in Chicago talking about today's biggest stories and telling you what they really mean. That show is this one. Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Some interesting new polling data out. Wall Street Journal surveying minority group voting trends. 30% of black men in the seven swing states will give their support to former President Donald Trump. That's up from the 12% he received in 2020. 30% in the seven swing states.
Wow.
That's substantial.
Black men are divorcing the Democrats.
Well, I mean, Jason Riley writes about this in the Journal, too, that working class minorities, particularly black men, are more concerned about the economy than they are identity politics. That's a problem for a party that's made identity politics its calling card. A new poll by Axios, in conjunction with Telemundo, finds 42% of Latino Americans support building a wall or fence along the entire U.S.-Mexico border. When pollsters asked that same question 3 years ago, December of 21, it was 30%. Now it's 42%. You know, that's a substantial move over the course of the last 3 years. And so one wonders just exactly how concerned the Democrats are. I hope they're very unconcerned, of course, because I'm rooting against them and working against them. But I mean, just in terms of a matter of politics here, what is it they think they're going to do to bring in the numbers they've historically enjoyed from black and Latino voters? I mean, Trump is competing to win Latino voters outright. And he's not going to win black voters outright, but I mean, if he's anywhere near 20%, that creates a real problem pulling the kind of numbers they need in swing states with big urban centers like North Carolina, you know, Charlotte, like Wisconsin, you know, Milwaukee. And obviously the Latino vote is substantial in a swing state like Arizona and a swing state like Nevada. The black population in Detroit and the Detroit metropolitan area in Michigan, which may be a swing state before all is said and done. So is there any real internal discussion happening as to what to do for, you know, if you're a Democrat and if you want Joe Biden to manage his way to a second term? For more on this, we're pleased to be joined by Brett Baer. He is the host of Special Report, of course, weekdays, 5 p.m. Chicago time. And he's also the author of many, many, many bestsellers. The most recent, To Rescue the Constitution, George Washington and the Fragile American Experiment, and a graphic novel entitled The History Club, Duel Across Time. Brett, thanks for joining us, as always. Appreciate it.
Good morning.
So what about that? I mean, what sort of scuttlebutt do you hear about how concerned Democrats are about the sort of numbers Trump is pulling among black and Latino voters, and if they are concerned, what they plan to do about it?
Yeah, very concerned. There's kind of red warning lights all over the place in D.C. when you talk to Democrats about those numbers. They're more concerned right now about, it seems, the Latino numbers being so dramatically different. Hence why President Biden did an interview with Univision last week and, you know, has gone to the Southwest states numerous times delivering speeches. But I don't know how effective that has been. It hasn't really moved numbers. As for the African-American vote, the black vote, I think that you're right. If Donald Trump moved just a couple of points, that would be a huge difference in every swing state. And, you know, when you're talking about margins that are really tight, probably down to 300,000 votes in about five states, that's a big deal.
Right. You know, it's interesting because it doesn't seem like there's any retrenchment in terms of positioning. There's been reporting about this internal, this internal debate discussion going on in the White House about how to pivot on border security. You had Mayorkas testify the other day and say, Yeah, maybe sanctuary city jurisdictions should work with ICE to remove violent criminals. You know, people that are here illegally who've been convicted of violent crimes. Maybe you can make an exception there, sort of what Eric Adams said a few weeks prior. But they seem to be really struggling to find a pivot that's acceptable to their base and would have real impact with swing voters.
Exactly. And they're trying to search for that, I think, in the hunt for that, they have been given this gift of Arizona and abortion. Mm. And that is really now the focus. And they will send Vice President Harris, and there'll be all kinds of focus on the issue of abortion based on what former President Trump said about leaving it to the states. Only a day later did Arizona have this court ruling that kind of went back to this 1864 law. So expect Democrats to focus on that and not immigration, because they don't have a solution.
Well, in regards to Trump and, you know, courting more black voters, I love what he did in Atlanta the other day. Just went into the Chick-fil-A spontaneously. It wasn't on their, you know, agenda.
And he was hungry.
Well, but he bought milkshakes for everybody, and like, he's genuine. You don't see that from President Biden at all. He's relating to people.
Right. Listen, Democrats would say that he's good in one-on-one scenarios. We just don't see it a lot about President Biden. You're right. And there are these viral moments with former President Trump in those environments. You know, I think it's interesting. I don't think we have a full sense of where the electorate is, especially when it comes to the black vote. I wouldn't be surprised if it's a tick or two higher than these polls say for former President Trump.
But I just think he should campaign. Go to the swing states and go to fast food restaurants. What do you think?
I think he'd be all on board for that. Yeah. Well, right. Sure. I mean,
why
the retail
not?
Politics.
You have nothing to lose.
Yeah. Well, but also, too, I mean, that's not inconsistent with who Trump has always been. You know, going back many, many decades when he was feted at Jesse Jackson luncheons in New York and given awards for his contributions to the black community through the construction industry. I mean, that's actually who he's always been. He's just sort of been painted because of the identity politics the left has committed to, you know, painted every utterance as some slight to some minority group, or it's an indication of his latent white supremacism or something like that. And I think more and more people are getting hip to how hyperbolic and, frankly, sans the evidence that is.
Yeah, I think that's true. And I doubt that we're going to see the end of that kind of ad. That we know we're for about 6 months of brutal campaigning on both sides, and it's going to get ugly, and there'll be all kinds of charges on identity politics and everything else.
You know, as somebody who's watched all these campaigns very closely for the last 8 years since Trump has been on the scene, does it strike you that he is, I mean, this is maybe an odd thing to say, but I think there is a real break, that he is more disciplined this time around? He seems more disciplined just with things like, like saying about RFK. He's not taking a shot at RFK. He's just saying, yeah, RFK, I like RFK Jr. He's, you know, more democratic on most of the issues than I am. But so he does. So basically say, hey, Democrats, if you don't like Biden, or you don't like me, go ahead, vote for RFK. I just need to take votes off of Biden. No problem. I'm fine with that. Him saying that the Marjorie Taylor Greene thing, trying to depose Mike Johnson, that's a distraction. That's a silly thing. He seems more disciplined in terms of playing realpolitik and not focusing so much on personal slights right now.
Yeah, I think that's this week.
Fair.
A couple weeks ago, he said that RFK Jr. was a super liberal, and was really hammering him on climate change stuff. But I think that at that point, he watched some story about how RFK Jr. may be taking votes from him, and I do think that overall the campaign is much more disciplined, and he does have more advisors like Chris LaCivita and others who are more savvy when it comes to the political implications of some of the things he says and does. Hence, this meeting with Speaker Johnson at Mar-a-Lago, I think that that's a signal that says, you know, get your house in order, House, because chaos does not sell in the election.
Now, I know you two are both big golfers, and the Masters is obviously underway. And I saw some video yesterday of Condoleezza Rice at one of the holes greeting some of the golfers. Is there any way, Trump, that would be a brilliant move if he chose her as his vice presidential running mate, don't you think?
No.
Yeah, of course, but she would never take it. She would never, ever, ever, ever take it. So I don't think he would ask.
Well, who's it going to be? What are you hearing?
You know, we've gone around and around and around about the possibilities. I mean, Tim Scott is still on the list and up there, but there are a lot of names that are around there. Lee Stefanik, Kristi Noem, Tulsi Gabbard. I think that he has to see some benefit, but there's also a school that says there should be somebody that independents and suburban women look at and like say, this is going to be somebody that's stable, that could be president, that is going to be a stable force that gives whispers in his ear, much like he's getting good advice on the campaign trail. So Mike Pompeo is somebody that gets tossed around. So I think there's still a lot of possibilities, and if I had to guess, it's going to be like The Apprentice, and it's going to go all the way to the convention.
You heard it here first. It's going to be Sarah Sanders. I think it's going to be Sarah Sanders.
All right.
Yeah, I think she checks the most boxes for him. I think, this will be obvious to you, Brett, but I mean, I think she has a good relationship with him, always has. She was a loyalist through the thick and the thin. That counts for him. She's now a governor. She is very room temperature. She's very reasonable. She's mom with a family.
Obviously she's governor now, but doesn't have a lot of, you know, can be president on day one vibes.
No.
But
she doesn't need to be
saying.
She doesn't need to be president on day one, though. And, you know, and once you're in that, you know, it's sort of like once you're in the presidency, you're sort of elevated, you know, just your stature is immediately elevated by the office. And so that happens, too, so long as she performs as I think she would. She's like a female Mike Pence, and I don't really mean that as a criticism, more than just a description, you know, contrasting personality types. And I think she's an explainer in a way that he isn't when it comes to some of the issues, like you just mentioned, perhaps most importantly, abortion.
Yeah, and I agree with you. She's very good on the stump, and I think that's definitely a name that's in the mix. My point is that I don't think he's going to make a decision until he has to at the very end.
Yeah, that's fair. I wanted to get your take on speaking of getting your house in order. I assume at the meeting with Speaker Johnson, since there's was some disagreement over reauthorization of Section 702 of FISA, that topic came up, and I know they're going back today to see if they can't come to agreement with the holdouts on FISA reauthorization. So how do you sense that plays out?
I think there's been a little bit of misunderstanding about 702 and some bad blood about obviously how the FBI has handled things vis-a-vis former President Trump. I mean, so 702 deals with foreign outsiders that very rarely do American citizens get wrapped into any surveillance that deals with that. And I think that there's going to be an effort to get at least some of the 19 over, but there will be support, bipartisan support. So I think Johnson moves it forward and takes the risk that Marjorie Taylor Greene is not going to do the motion to vacate to get rid of him.
All right, who do you have this weekend in the Masters?
Oh, boy, here we go.
Here we go.
All right, we got
the more important.
Don't say Tiger Woods.
It looks strong. Yeah, I think Scottie Scheffler is in the best spot. Obviously, he's playing the best. I kind of like Dustin Johnson as a long.
Really? Interesting.
Yeah, he's playing really well.
I got my guy Hovland, who put on that show at the BMW last year. I think I'm going to stick with Victor Hovland, even though we're already through round one. So, but yeah. And how's your game these days?
Coming along, yeah. I'm playing next week in a tournament in Dallas, invited Celebrity Classic, and so it all is getting ready for the Lake Tahoe in July. That's the big thing. If I can finish on the top of a leaderboard, and NBC has to put the Fox guy up there, that's a really good thing.
Oh, are you awesome. Are you a scratch? What are you
I'm
playing
a two.
To? You're a two?
A two.
Two index.
Yep.
All right.
So
well,
I'm a walking wallet right now. I mean, I'm giving a lot of money away, but
believe me, yeah, I know the feeling. Yeah, I know the feeling too. Right, I'm a 2.7 index that's been shooting in the low 80s. So that's not in the money, as you know.
Well, we got to play sometimes.
Yeah,
absolutely,
yeah.
Absolutely.
Have you had a hole in one yet?
You know, I don't have.
I have had a hole in one.
Where'd you have your? How many?
Just one when I was 14 years old.
Oh, good for you. I had one when I was 22 years old. Yes.
I'm a dry spell. That's right.
You had one when you were two?
I said 22 years old.
Oh, 22.
Yeah, in Tucson.
Two would have been impressive.
Yeah, that would have been.
Yeah, that would have been.
Be a protege. Where'd you get your hole in one?
In Atlanta, Georgia, where I grew up. And it's been a long time. Been very close several times, but nothing since then.
All right.
And I know where Dan got his.
Yeah.
Just tell him.
Bull Valley.
I know. I pay homage to you every time I hit that hole.
No, that was just a really tough course, by the way. You know, the course that Gary Rabin owns. Anyway, I don't have Fox News paying for my putting greens and stuff like that, but I'm still, despite that disadvantage, I'm still happy to host you at Olympia Fields anytime, or if you ever get down to Naples, Old Florida, the guys at Old Florida would love to see you. So.
Oh, they're great. They're great. Oh, I'd love to do it. We'll get it. We'll get it on the books.
Brett Baer, host of Fox News Special Report, 5 p.m. weekdays, Chicago time. To Rescue the Constitution and the History Club are his latest bestsellers. Pick them up. Brett, thank you as always.
See ya.
Thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
This is the morning show. More Chicago radio listeners are choosing. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer. Only the biggest stories, only the biggest guests, and only the biggest opinions. This is AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. This was a fun moment. You know, there's nothing better than hearing from people who've emigrated to this country from totalitarian countries about America. What they experienced versus what they see here. And both the good and the concerning. So this exchange, and a good example of this, we had her on when her book first came out, Xi Van Fleet from Virginia, who Chinese immigrant who lived through Mao as a young girl. And she sees, unfortunately, a lot of the earmarks of the Cultural Revolution in communist China and in this country right now with our political ruling class. So this exchange is of that kind, actually. A young woman, Chinese immigrant, confronts David Hogg. Remember David Hogg?
Oh, yeah. From Parkland. Mm-hmm.
Parkland survivor who became a outspoken and rather disagreeable proponent of taking away people's Second Amendment rights to protect themselves. Well, he's still out on the trail. And by the way, he didn't get any better from going to Harvard, as one can imagine. He's still on the speaker circuit, on the campaign trail, as it were, pushing the same anti-individual rights agenda, which is what it is, properly termed. And here's what he had to respond to at a recent talk he gave. Take a listen.
Hi, my name is Lily Tang Williams. Welcome to my live free or die state. Actually, I am a Chinese immigrant who survived communism. And under Mao, 40 million people were starving to death after he sold communism to them. And 20 million people died, murdered during his Cultural Revolution. So my question to you, David, is that can you guarantee me a gun owner tonight? Our government in the U.S., in D.C., will never, never become a tyrannical government. Can you guarantee that to me?
there's no way I can ever guarantee that any government will not be tyrannical.
Well, then the debate on gun control is over because I will never give up my guns. Never, never. And you should go to China to see how gun control works for dictatorship of CCP.
Mm-hmm. Great to hear from people who know, as opposed to people who've been, you know, propagandized beyond the ability to reason, like young Mr. Hogg. For more on this and other topics, cultural and political, Tony Perkins joins us. He's the president of the Family Research Council. He's also a former state representative in Louisiana. And he is the host of a new show on Salem Radio Network and Salem News Channel entitled This Week on the Hill. His debut this Sunday at 1 p.m. on our airwaves, 1 p.m. at AM 560, features none other than House Speaker Mike Johnson. Tony Perkins, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Dan, good to be with you and Amy this morning.
Thank you for joining us. So, yeah, how about that? You know, it's very interesting to hear those perspectives because they're sort of curtain closers. Xi Van Fleet in Virginia during a lot of the tumult at the school board level that led to the rise of Glenn Youngkin there. And, you know, on the gun issue, which I don't want to say the debate is ever settled, but even most Democrats don't want to go there in this period of Soros funded prosecutors who don't prosecute and politicians who are just a couple of iterations of the official story away from calling for the defunding of police.
Yeah, this is one of those issues. It's clear contrast, as you just heard, between those who want freedom and those who don't have an appreciation for freedom, and their policies are leading toward tyrannical government. In fact, this is one of the issues that we're going to be talking about because these things are real. And with the slim majority, 218 Republicans to 215 Democrats, you know, we've got a one-vote margin for the House. If we were to lose control of the House, these are the type of policies that would be pushed forward by the Democrats to eliminate the Second Amendment, to impose their radical views on abortion on the entire nation, abortion till the moment of birth at taxpayer expense. That's the kind of stuff we're talking about, the very real policies.
Speaking of the abortion issue in the wake of that state Supreme Court ruling in Arizona, the contrast is very interesting on the topic. It sort of implicates what you just described in terms of where President Trump is, as he announced earlier this week, and where Biden is, where President Trump is essentially taking the approach of federalism. Thanks to my nominees to the Supreme Court, we overturned bad law in Roe. And that's the pro-life side wanted this return to the states. And you've got to fight this out at the state level. And that's what my position is, versus Biden is promising to take federal action to impose his will on the nation through the Congress if he can't get it through the Supreme Court.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. This is what they've done for 40-plus years, actually 50 going back to Roe v. Wade, is imposing it through the courts. So here's what happened in Arizona. Arizona just simply said, the Arizona Supreme Court said the legislature is the one that decides the policy, not the courts. And so the legislature is free to, you know, come to that point of consensus. That's what we want. We wouldn't be having this conversation if it were not for President Trump, as you just laid out what he had to say, his Supreme Court nominees, his administration led to reversing Roe v. Wade and allowing this issue to be decided by policymakers. Now, that said, there is still a role for the federal government. There's consensus at the federal level that the government shouldn't be funding or facilitating abortion. But real policy, and I say this as a former state legislator who enacted a number of pro-life policies, that's where we're going to reach consensus the quickest, mm-hmm. is at the state level, and the state should be able to do that. To contrast with what the Democrats want, they want to impose, and they've already passed this through the House under Democratic leadership, but they couldn't get it through the Senate back at the time, is the Women's Health Protection Act, which would eliminate almost every pro-life law in the nation and impose abortion until birth at taxpayer expense on every state in the nation. So they're not being honest. They're out there trying to twist and distort the Republican position because they want to hide their own position.
Speaking of Speaker Johnson, who you kick off your new show with, give us your assessment of the job he's done with that slim majority you were just describing, and a wide variety of opinion on a number of topic areas, from national security to taxing and spending.
Well, that's what we're going to talk about this weekend. Is we're going to unpack that. We're going to go about beyond the headlines and the sound bites, and talk about what we can do, what he can do with this slim majority, and the consequence. You know, a lot of people said, let's shut down the government. And he and I have talked about that, and he's not opposed to shutting down the government. You've got to have a plan. So we're going to talk about that this weekend, is what options does he have as the speaker? And, you know, what the speaker has to lead the entire Congress, a very diverse Congress. But even among Republicans, with those 218, he's got to get every one of those votes in order to pass legislation. And so it's a very difficult job. Slimmest majority in the history of the Congress. I don't think too many people want that job. And we're going to talk to him about that this weekend.
What about his relationship with Marjorie Taylor Greene as they're in this standoff?
They actually met this week. They had about an hour-long conversation discussing the situation, and that's another topic we're going to talk about. We're going to talk about vacating the chair. Is that a real threat? What could come of that? As I alluded to a few moments ago, what could happen if there is a motion to vacate, given the slim majority that the Republicans have? The Republicans, for the first time in the history of the Congress, could actually lose control of the Congress and it flip to Democrats in the middle of a session, giving the president the ability to get his agenda through both the House and the Senate. That would be horrific for Americans, because the Second Amendment would be at risk. We're talking about the sanctity of human life. We're talking about schools and what is happening at the local level. There's a thin red line, if you will, with just one Republican standing in the way of the Democrats having their entire agenda enacted.
So with respect to Mike Johnson, you know, it's not often we have somebody in the speaker's chair who is a conservative and an intellectual. And so my main criticism of Mike Johnson, get your feedback on this, maybe you pose it to him. Is that he hasn't done enough to leverage that ability that he has to be an explainer, to frame issues, to make the argument so that people understand exactly what the choices are. He's fallen back into essentially being a mechanic. And I know that's an important part of the job. And, you know, again, managing all of those, herding all of those cats, as it were, in his caucus. But when it comes to things like government shutdown, frame the issue. Say, look, what we're talking about with respect to the open border is a real threat to the republic, and it is something where we should be willing to essentially use the power that we have, the power of the purse, to say we're not doing anything until we address this, to force the hand of the Senate, to force the hand of the executive. But look, I don't have the votes to do that. And I have to respect people who disagree, and we have to build coalitions. So, you know, that becomes an engagement opportunity for the American people, both with their representatives now and as they contemplate who they want their representatives to be in November. But understand where I'm coming from and why I think it's as important as it is that, you know, whatever power the federal government has in the opposition to these policies needs to be brought to bear. But I just don't have the support to bring it to bear at this moment, and, you know, drive different sorts of conversations rather than just sort of the mechanical ones about slim majorities and, you know, claiming that it's all Biden's fault. Yeah, it is. But, you know, show some sort of like vision and, you know, constructive philosophy in terms of how this could happen if the balance of power was a little bit different, and maybe if the electorate was a little bit more engaged.
Yeah, that's a great point, Dan, and that is really the genesis behind This Week on the Hill that I'll be hosting each week with the speaker. He'll be on each week with me, and this is to provide that platform to go beyond the filtration of the legacy media to talk to the American people, to conservative voters about these issues. And what would be the consequences of shutting down the government? What leverage do we have that we can actually advance a conservative philosophy and conservative policies forward? And so that's actually what we're going to be exploring, and we're even going to look at that this weekend. But that's the reason for this platform this week on the Hill, is to be able to be uncensored by the media, to go beyond the headlines, go beyond the sound bites, and actually talk about what's happening behind the marble pillars on Capitol Hill.
Great. Well, we'll be looking forward to that. Tony Perkins is, of course, the president of the Family Research Council, former state legislator in Louisiana, and he's the host of the new show we've been just discussing. That's both on Salem Radio Network and Salem News Channel, This Week on the Hill, and it features House Speaker Mike Johnson every week. It debuts this Sunday on our airwaves, Sunday at 1 p.m. here on AM 560, This Week on the Hill with Tony Perkins and Speaker Mike Johnson. Tony, thanks for joining us, and best of luck with the show.
All right, Dan, great to be with you and Amy this morning. Have a great weekend.
Thanks. You too, and he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer.
Your show keeps me alive during the week. There's nobody I'd rather listen to between 5 and 9 in the morning than you guys.
On AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. So after the body cam video of the police-involved shooting in which Dexter Reed was killed was released, the Cook County State's Attorney, Kim Fox, had this to say.
If the evidence proves beyond a reasonable doubt that the force used was illegal, our office will file criminal charges.
I just found that to be an odd thing to say, because of course that's the case. If the evidence proves that somebody broke the law, then we're duty bound to prosecute them, which is not exactly always the position that Kim Fox takes. But she made a point to say that about the police officers involved in the Dexter Reed matter.
Yeah.
Despite the fact that we saw from the body cam videos, plural, multiple body cams, that he is the one who opened fire on officers.
From watching that, like her tone and her attitude, it's as if she's already convicted them in her mind, the police officers.
Well, there's something else, too, because, you know, there's something else, too, about this, because all of this discussion about the pretextual stop. Why are you stopping for making a stop over not wearing a seatbelt, not to mention tinted windows and so forth? Let's say it was a bad stop. Okay. Cook County State's Attorney Kim Fox. Let's say it was a bad stop. Let's say they profiled him. There's no evidence of that, but let's say it. You want to ask those questions? You want to investigate? Go ahead. So let's say you find out it's a bad stop. It's pretty clear. In fact, it's black letter law that a bad stop wouldn't justify opening fire on police officers. So even in that case, the response by Mr. Reed was unjustified. And the response of police officers to protect themselves was justified, because, you see, if it's a bad stop, Kim Fox, you would think the Cook County State's Attorney would know this. This is why we have courts of law. The police treated me unfairly. The police stopped me because they were racial profiling me. That's not an argument that gets adjudicated on the street. That's an argument that gets adjudicated in a court of law. Isn't that right, Cook County State's Attorney Fox? Oh, nobody in the Chicago Press Corps bothered to ask. What a surprise. For more on this and other law and order matters, we're pleased to be joined again by Bob Mylan. He's a former first assistant state's attorney for Cook County. He's also a former assistant U.S. attorney for the Northern District of Illinois. Bob, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
Happy to join this morning.
So what was your reaction to what Kim Fox specifically said? Am I being too hard on State's Attorney Fox?
Yeah, I actually think you are. I heard her entire statement. The little clip you played really didn't represent what she said. She, I thought her statements were spot on. Gonna call it the way she sees it, and I thought her statements were balanced and very well done. Actually, the problem I had with the public statements was the letter that the head of COPA sent to Superintendent Snelling that went public. That's where, to me, the big issue was. I mean, look, COPA's job is to conduct an independent and thorough investigation with a sense of urgency. You're supposed to provide a fact-based and a transparent report of what happened and then make a determination on whether excessive force was used or not, or any type of wrongdoing. And by presenting the videos and opinions after 19 days was in my opinion, a big mistake, and some regrettable comments, especially, and I'm talking about the letter that went public. About
stripping them of police powers?
Yeah, I mean, for instance, you know, she writes in the letter, there were serious questions about the proportionality of the officer's use of deadly force. In my opinion, that's a premature and naive statement to make. I mean, what were the officers supposed to do? Are they supposed, after the offender fires repeatedly and wounds one of their colleagues, are they supposed to say, Joe to my left fired four times, I fired six, Dexter Reed has fired 10, so we can fire another one? But it doesn't work that way, and anybody that watches the video knows that it's kind of a ridiculous statement.
You are also
fighting for your life.
Well, wait a second.
For your life at that moment. And for them to talk about the proportionality of the response, I found naive and regrettable.
Well, first of all, the clip I played from Kim Fox was ABC7, so you have to take that up with Chuck Gowdy. But I did listen to her whole statement as well, and the problem I have is emphasis, and then also what's left out. So she stood there with the representative of COPA and the mayor. I didn't hear her say anything along the lines of what you just said about COPA. I didn't hear the mayor say anything about that either. I also didn't hear her say anything if she's going to, you know, offer this balance in terms of how the public is supposed to process these things. I didn't hear her say anything about what I said either, that this idea, as we heard in the press conference with the family and the plaintiff's attorneys, that he was afraid. And so we're supposed to somehow insinuate that was, and they were yelling at him and they had guns drawn when he didn't comply with their commands, that somehow it justifies what he did, or somehow the officers were in the wrong. And there was no additional context that she provided to that.
No, yeah. And look, I want to go back to what I said originally. This issuing the videos and making these statements 19 days is a mistake on everybody's part. They should have waited, right? At this stage of the investigation, they don't know what they don't know. Mm-hmm. And so for all of them to get up there, it was too early, right? It's just too early. And there's too many unanswered questions. I mean, and again, I had no problem with Kim's statement. I thought she was, considering the situation, I thought she was pretty much spot on. It was the letter from the head of COPA to Snelling that was the problem. I mean, she went on to say something else. She said, you know, four officers fired after Reed exited his vehicle unarmed. I mean, you have to wonder if they watched the video. I mean, if you watch the video after this guy fires multiple times, he either intentionally or unintentionally drives into a squad in a parked car, and he gets out the driver's side, and the view of him is blocked. You can't see him because he's between the police officer's car and his own car when he walks out. They have no way of knowing whether he still has the gun or not.
Right.
But so there's no reason to say that 19 days in. You know, I just don't get it. And then, you know, it goes on to say, you know, one officer fired three shots, you know, after Reed was already on the ground. But if you watch it, it's like a matter of 4 seconds, right? So you have this crazy shootout where people's lives are on the line. Actually, a life was lost. And you have to throw that in without saying, by the way, when he was firing those shots, he had to reload. So he's looking down at his gun reloading, and then he kept firing. And it's a matter of 3 or 4 seconds from the time Mr. Reed goes down to the last shots are fired. it's just not necessary, especially 19 days out. And it doesn't help, right? You would think that that day was designed to quell the public, but they caused more questions than answers. And, you know, the one thing that's shocking to me is just this disparity between what people think about the police. You know, I mean, I watch that and I see brave, brave, brave men and women. I mean, really, it's an honorable job. It is an admirable job, but it's unbelievably dangerous. But that's what I see. And then there's a whole bunch of the public that sees something else. And the sad commentary about Chicago.
Well, specifically in this letter from COPA to Snelling, they said it's uncertain how the officers could have seen this seatbelt violation, given their location relative to Reed's vehicle and the dark tints on his windows. So it's like they're again, what you're maintaining is that they're prosecuting the police officers before doing a full investigation.
Exactly. They're prejudging this. How do they know that? Did they interview all of them yet? I don't know if they did or not, right? What was the source of that? What was that attribute? Who was that attributed to? Was it attributed to the officers that pulled them over? Yeah, we did it for a seatbelt. Or was it attributed to something else? The public doesn't know. So why go there, right? You know, why go there? I mean, tactical units generally don't pull people over for seatbelts, right? They, you know, they're out there. What do? They're out there looking for guns, right? Every year, how many times have you heard a police superintendent in the past 15 years or a mayor say, we got 10,000 guns off the street, right? How do they get them off the street? That's how they get them off the street, right? Maybe they have information about that vehicle. Maybe it was the tinted windows. I don't know. None of us know, right? And they make traffic stops, and maybe they find guys who have pending cases, right, like an unlawful use of weapon and things like that. They make traffic stops and they find the guns, and that's how they recover them. But to be issuing these kind of statements 19 days out, completely unnecessary.
Yeah, like guys who have unlawful use of a weapon cases against them, like Dexter Reed did, to your point. The other thing, though, too, is it with the politicians and the media does is they foment conversations that drive us in a completely different direction. So, for example, in this case, the conversation that's dominant, absent pushback, which is happening, but I mean, it's still the dominant conversation being pushed by the stakeholders I mentioned, is let's talk about traffic stops. Let's talk about whether tactical units should even exist. We have Sheila Betty from Northwestern Law referring to tactical units as out on the hunt and calling Dexter Reed, in this case, their prey. And that's what, you know, this is, you know, talk about how so many Chicagoans see something completely different than what you see, because they're being directed by quote-unquote experts, by officers of the court like Miss Betty and politicians to say, well, exactly, they were just looking for the random person to pull over, and they frightened him, and he should be frightened because the police are out to get him because he's their prey.
Right. And, you know, it's those types of people that are making comments like that and stirring things up and making the city more dangerous when you're saying things like that. They're the first ones to call 911 when they need them. You know, that's what's laughable about all these comments. You know, all these cops are out and they're preying on people and they're terrible people and they're doing all this. But the first time they're in trouble, they're the first ones that dial 911.
Yep.
So, yeah, it's a joke. And here's the other thing that bothers me, the mayor's comments. Although they were measured in some way, he brings race into it, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's another black man that was shot and killed, and I've raised, you know, I'm raising young black men, and the shooting had nothing to do with race. I mean, zero. So why go there? The shooting happened because a young man drew a weapon and fired at the police and got shot back. That's what happened. The videos say that. Everybody knows that, right?
Right.
And the fact of the matter is the wounded police officer is black. So why are we talking about that, right? And it doesn't help the city. Right? Everybody, you know, we have this for this theme over the years, we're one Chicago, we're one Chicago. Really? Well, then let's be one Chicago. A young man was killed, right? A police officer was shot. That's what happened. But there's no reason to, and it happened because there was a gun in a vehicle and the guy used it, right? But it had nothing to do with the race of Dexter Reed.
If you were the incoming Cook County State's Attorney, coming in next year after the November election, what sort of challenge? I mean, the challenges are many, but in terms of like as an outsider who was an insider, how would you conceive of prioritizing the challenges that you have? What are some first steps that a Cook County State's Attorney and needs to do in that office to work better with police, work better with the fifth floor, work better with Tim Evans and the courts?
Yeah, the first step is you have to surround yourself with the best talent possible. So, I'm assuming it's going to be Eileen O'Neill Burke. I think it's pretty much done. And what she should be doing right now is talking to people and getting the best and the brightest just around her, because you can't do it alone. You need to lean on people, you need advice, and you need really, really good people. So that's number one. Number two, she should be analyzing what are the biggest issues in the office right now. One of them is post-convictions. You really have to hire a lot of people to handle that unit in all those cases. There are all these old cases are coming back, and they just don't have, there's not enough people in that unit now, and they need to probably triple it to do it the right way. And then going back to, what you just discussed, meet often with the superintendent of police, meet with the chief judge, let them know what your expectations are, what their expectations are, and keep an open door, but listen. And that's what she should be doing right now.
What impact do you think, maybe it's too early, I'm not sure, impact the Safety Act has had on the job of maintaining law and order in Chicago and Cook County?
It's had a big impact. And I've talked about this before. The original version was ridiculous, right? I mean, it was ridiculous what it would have done to the streets of Chicago. And I saw it on TV while they're all shaking hands, the governor and all these state reps and state senators that were going to get it, that got it passed, and they're all high-fiving each other, knowing that people are going to get, innocent people are going to get killed in Chicago. So when there was an uproar, they changed it, and it's way better than it was, the original version. But still, you go on CWB blog or you read about anything, and you got 17-time convicted felon comes into court again, and because it's only a PSMV, possession of a stolen motor vehicle, he's released on the street again. Or it's a felony retail theft, and he's released on the street again. It's in their mind not a violent offense. Or an individual who has already been convicted of armed robbery twice, picks up a stolen car case or something like that. And because the case he's charged with that day isn't a violent crime, he's released on the street again. When common sense tells you that all he is an armed robber in a hot car, right? He's still the armed robber. Mm-hmm. And so that's what's going on out there. And so they just keep sending them back out there and, putting them on the street. And what do we see? We see people doing 5, 6, 7, 8 carjackings, right? And repeated robberies and driving their vehicles into fashion windows and driving their vehicles into businesses and looting them. And, it's ridiculous. And so until some people start stepping up and saying, look, this has to change, what are we going to do about the repeat offenders that you're calling nonviolent that really aren't nonviolent, right? What are we going to do about it? So there's a lot of work to be done.
Bob Mylan, former first assistant state's attorney for Cook County and former assistant U.S. attorney for the Northern District of Illinois as well. Bob, thank you as always for your insights. Appreciate it.
Good talking to you. Take care.
Thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Before you see it on TV, share it on Facebook, or read about it in the paper, hear it here first. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer.
Open mic! Open mic Friday! Call in now! Open mic Friday!
Yes, it's that time of the week, Open Mic Friday, taking your calls with comments, criticisms, compliments, concerns, general crack pottery. We'll take it all. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. Open Mic Friday is sponsored by Turnkey.pro, and founder of said Turnkey.pro kicks it off. He is David Kolsak, who joins us now. David?
Good morning, Dan and Amy. And hey, Dan, nice to have you back. It's been a little while.
Thank you. I was fishing. I was gone fishing.
Good for you. Good for you. Well, I finished in second place in my office pool for the NCAA, just like my team. So that's
nice.
Pretty good. I feel good.
It was a fun run. It was great to watch.
So you got
to.
I assume you're a Purdue booster. You know, get with Matt Painter and get a little stronger backcourt, and figure out how you're going to replace Zach Edey. I don't know how you do that, and maybe you'll be back.
Mason Gillis just announced he's gone too. So Mason Gillis entered the portal today. So there's that. So we've got some holes to fill.
There you go.
So first off, today would have been my dad's 89th birthday. So hey, Dad, miss you. Anyway. I wanted to talk about something that happened around this time in the year 1912. The official narrative is that the Titanic set sail on April 11th, 1912, on a voyage from England to New York. It sank under mysterious circumstances, striking an iceberg on its starboard side on April 14th, sinking and killing about 1,500 people in the frigid waters of the North Atlantic.
Including Leonardo DiCaprio.
Got a lot of questions.
Yeah.
The first question I have is, how the heck almost an exact depiction of the Titanic disaster was detailed in a book written 14 years before it sank. This book was written in 1898 called The Wreck of the Titan or Futility. It was a novella written by a guy called Morgan Robertson, who claimed he wrote it based on a vision he had. And he had a lot of knowledge about shipbuilding to boot. So this book, The Wreck of the Titan, again, written 14 years before the Titanic sunk, has an amazing similarity to the actual story that we're told about the Titanic. Could it be that the author was clairvoyant, or did he know it was going to happen? Both very implausible. However, the similarities between the Titan, the ship in the book, and the Titanic go far beyond the name and the iceberg. The length of the Titan was 800 feet, the Titanic 882. The speed at which the Titan cruised into an iceberg was 25 knots, the Titanic's was 22.5. The Titan held 2,500 passengers, the Titanic held 2,200, though both had a capacity of 3,000. Both of those ships were British-owned. Both ships were hit on the starboard bow around midnight. Both sank in the North Atlantic, exactly 400 nautical miles from Newfoundland. Both had severe lack of lifeboats, the Titan holding 24, the Titanic carrying just 20, and both had triple-screw propellers. Though there are a few differences, there are few and far between. For example, the Titan sinking only left 13 survivors, while the Titanic left 705, and the Titan actually capsized before sinking whereas the Titanic, as we saw in the movie, split into two. Furthermore, the Titan was headed from New York to England, while the Titanic was headed from England to New York. The similarities are striking, and I would encourage you to look what I'm talking about. As you could imagine, though, the similarities between these two have sparked numerous conspiracy theories over the years. Some say the Titanic was sunk on purpose. Let's just say for a minute that it was. The question would be, why? Why would someone purposefully sink a ship of that size with that many fatalities? And here's the conspiracy part, Dan. There were three notable and very wealthy men on that ship. Their names were John Jacob Astor, real estate magnate and prominent Astor family member, Benjamin Guggenheim, another American businessman and prominent Guggenheim family member, and Isidore Strauss, who famously owned Macy's with his brother. These were not just normal guys, but really high-profile leaders in their respective fields. They also opposed the creation of the Federal Reserve, not because they were looking out for the people, but rather looking out for their own fortunes. They didn't want a central bank messing with their more retail-based interests. So now let's just say the ship sank by accident. It doesn't change the fact that these prominent businessmen perished. What's more interesting is that J.P. Morgan, the owner of White Star Line and ultimate owner of the Titanic, took out an insurance policy for $5 million on the Titanic just 2 weeks before the disaster, and at the last minute, he failed to board the ship on its maiden voyage. He was supposed to be on it. So he survived, and so did his companies. One of them is called J.P. Morgan Chase, and it's still around. But there are other interesting things that happened after the Titanic sunk. Basically, 1 year to the day, on April 15th, the Federal Reserve was put in place, and that's still around today as well. Also interesting to note is that tax day lands every year in the U.S. on April 15th. That's still around, too. And remember, the author of the Titan book, Morgan Robertson, died on March 24th, 1915, in his hotel room in Atlantic City of mysterious circumstances at 53. So we fast forward to today, where the Federal Reserve is still in charge as a foreign corporation operating in the United States. They control all the monetary supply, most notably interest rates. The Fed had indicated they were going to ease interest rates several times this year, but in the face of all this inflation, they can't at this moment. Maybe they can later this year. There's an election. So as we approach tax day, we can thank the Federal Reserve and the IRS, and for the IRS anyway, and think about what life would have been like without banks enslaving all of us to mortgages, car loans, and credit card debt, to name a few. But my question will always be, if the Fed can simply print money out of thin air, why do we even pay taxes? And this is what makes the BRICS movement so interesting to me. The collection of nations is growing fast of the countries that want to be a part of that BRICS system. Zimbabwe just introduced a gold-backed currency. Could it be a dry run for the BRICS movement to watch, to see what goes right and what goes wrong? Because when you tie your currency to something like gold, over tying it to a promise, a wink, and a nod, then you've got a completely different system. So however the Fed was created, either by hook or crook, it changed everything, and it still does today. Surely the Titanic sinking could have just happened by accident. It may also just be a coincidence that the sinking of the Titanic removed three of the strongest opposing voices to the Federal Reserve. Coincidentally, it could be also that the Titan book and the Titanic stories are just almost identical for no reason. So my question is, how many coincidences do you have to see in order for it to be mathematically impossible? Just some things to think about when you're paying your taxes this year. So in conclusion, it's no coincidence that paying taxes that foment wars, protect other people's borders, and line the pockets of politicians is a Titanic disaster. See how I did that?
I see how you wrap that all nicely. So now, did the guy who wrote that novella, The Titan, is he somehow a distant relative of James Cameron? And he was setting up Jim Cameron to write that blockbuster. And
You never know. It's just kind of fun stuff to look at.
All right. Thanks for the call. Thanks for kicking us off, David. We appreciate it. And Lincoln's secretary was named Kennedy, and Kennedy's secretary was named Lincoln. Okay.
And the Titanic exhibition is in Chicago right now, Westfield Old Orchard, if you want to go.
And who predicted Celine Dion would lose their voice after the Titanic?
Oh, my God.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 64636, turnkey.pro text line on this open mic Friday. I'm sorry, you wanted to offer
something? I wanted to talk about O.J. Simpson and his passing and, you know.
Oh, thank you.
Well, the nine-month trial.
Hold on.
O.J. Simpson's new fitness video was released this week, and hitting the shelves next week, Simpson's newest video, Dorf on Stocking.
You have to be of a certain age to appreciate that. Remember Tim Conway's Dorf on Golf?
Yes.
That was popular. I had that. Yeah. Dorf on Stalking.
Dorf on Stalking.
There were more books and more Norm MacDonald jokes. I love these.
And the Pope came out with a book this week, which contains a series of essays examining faith and morality in today's secular world and the changing role of the Catholic Church as it approaches the 21st century. The book is entitled God Himself Told Me That O.J. is Guilty. In other book news, Prince Charles released an autobiography in which he states that he never loved Princess Di and that his father pressured him to marry her. The book is entitled, Of Course O.J. Did It. I mean, come on. And finally, in honor of the 50th anniversary of their first publication, Random House will be releasing special commemorative issues of many Dr. Seuss classics. The first to hit the bookshelves will be Green Eggs and Ham and O.J. is Guilty.
But the same thing, it doesn't get old, and I've listened to these repeatedly since yesterday.
Norm MacDonald was the best. We miss him. On commemorating O.J.'s death, go watch his last comedy special, Hitler's Dog. It's great. All right, I'm sorry, you were saying.
Oh, yes, I was saying. Okay, so the nine-month trial, and where I worked, we had it on every single day for 9 months. And what I learned yesterday from Judge Jeanine Pirro is that the gloves didn't fit O.J. Simpson. Well, one, because he had the rubber gloves on underneath, but also, two, because the blood-stained gloves had shrunk because they were stained with blood. But also, Johnny Cochran told him not to take his arthritis medication so that his joints would swell up. Isn't that pretty brilliant?
So what are you trying to – are you trying to say O.J. did it?
No. yeah, but you know what? He was the real murderer here, not O.J. Simpson, Dan. You – and other people who work here who did not get vaccinated, you're murderers.
Hey, Twitter world, it's me, yours truly. It's heard something really interesting today. You know, with 99 or whatever percent of people dying or the unvaccinated from the new COVID stuff, and over 90% of hospitalizations, especially in Florida, are among the unvaccinated. A female doctor was on this morning. She made the best analogy I've heard. She said that being vaccinated is like wearing your seatbelt. That it doesn't guarantee you won't get in an accident, but if you do, you have a much better chance of surviving. Hey, get your shots. I don't like wearing masks. And as you people who aren't getting the shots that has brought this mask thing back, I'm just saying.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of people don't know this, that Orenthal James Simpson became an epidemiologist later in life.
Him and Bill Gates and other people.
You know, there's actually a good piece about the impact of the O.J. Simpson trial in Variety, and I don't get to say that very much. This piece, just a couple of excerpts by Daniel Diodario. The media age ushered in by his presence, his saga, and his white Bronco remains very much with us. The media age we're in now. And it really talks about how the last 30 years, including what O.J. did subsequent to his acquittal, speaks to the sort of, I don't know, cultural rot in America. I don't know a better way to say it. He writes in explanation that Simpson had in his car chase seemed to be in a state of extreme distress, but his unwillingness to turn himself in looks in the context of the rest of his life like presence of mind, not madness. For those hours, he was preposterously evading trouble and prolonging freedom simply by dint of his unwillingness to slow down. The lessons our culture learned from this were found in the watching. Millions upon millions absorbed that the news is best told as an endlessly rollicking celebrity-fueled drama, and that those who make the news could find their best advantage by treating their role in it as that of a star finding their light. Every day, at least since the two Simpson projects first aired, meaning those documentaries a decade ago, in the consequential year of 2016, is a slow-speed car chase, and we're all riveted. Really, think about the era over the last decade of social media influencers and ghastly reality shows. I think that's a pretty good description of what has come in the 30 years since that trial, and it's certainly an aspect of at least part of our culture.
Not forget about the victims. Ron Goldman, Stevenson High School grad. Mm-hmm. His father, Fred, said upon hearing of the news, it's no great loss to the world. And the director of Naked Gun said, rest in peace, Nord Berg. His acting was a lot like his murdering. He got away with it, but no one believed him.
That was different than the tone that was struck by the regime. Mr. 10%'s spokeshuman, Karine Jean-Pierre.
I'll say this. Our thoughts are with his families during this difficult time, obviously with his family and loved ones. And I'll say this. I know that they have asked for some privacy, and so we're going to respect that. I'll just leave it there.
What about Ron Goldman's family?
Very somber, Karine Jean-Pierre. Pete, in Arlington Heights, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Hi, good morning. I just wanted to make the comment that tomorrow is the monthly meeting for the Republicans of Wheeling Township, and the guest speaker is going to be Paul Vallis.
Oh, Brandon Johnson was unavailable?
Yeah, I'm going to be there to ask Paul if he would have won in front of all these Republicans, who would you have supported in the presidential election? My second question would be,
right,
what are you even doing here, and why were you invited? Thank you.
Well, be respectful.
Good questions.
I wonder who did invite him, and I'm curious as why he accepted it. Maybe he's changing parties?
Who cares?
I know, he's not going to run for anything.
And by the way, changing parties, there's only one party. Yeah. What are you changing from and to? I'm sorry to hear that Wheeling Township doesn't have enough self-respect to invite Republicans, conservatives, to address the group. But that shows the level of capitulation here. And it speaks to why people don't waste their time, talent, and resources on the Republican Party. Paul Vallis? The guy who trashed Ron DeSantis? In addition to trashing Trump, of course. I'm sorry, the guy who was promoting abortion on demand. What part of Paul Vallis? Oh, because he is for school choice. So is Juan Williams. Is Juan Williams going to be the Lincoln Day speaker at Republican events around the state now? Is that next? No self-respect, no fight. All cowardice and capitulation. Oh, we're reaching out. No, you're not. No, you're not. Pathetic. Thanks for letting us know, Pete. Thanks for letting people know, don't bother. Just bide your time until you can get out. Bob in Buffalo Grove.
Good morning, Amy and Dan. Always good talking to you. In discussing the OJ subject, in news reports, I have yet to hear anyone address this topic. I'm just wondering, in the interest of medical science, should OJ have a brain autopsy? I'm wondering if he had CTE issues. And is anyone monitoring his CTE impact on his emotional behavior? I mean, when the trial took place, nobody knew about CTE. And I'm just wondering if that had any impact on his behavior. Your thoughts?
I don't really have any. I mean, I don't really care, Bob. And CTE is an issue, and there's been any number of tragedies over the years. I agree, the Dave Duersons and the Junior Seau's and many others. Mike Webster, they made the film about him. But no, I'm not interested in providing some sort of bull jive rationalization for the crimes that OJ committed. Janice in Morocco, Indiana.
Hi, Dan and Amy. I wonder if creepy, corrupt old man Joe Biden would agree to debate Donald Trump if the debate takes place in Biden's basement, surrounded by his visiting angels. Trump did say anytime, any place, Joe.
All right, Janice. Nick, Northwest Side.
Yeah, thank you. I want to say that when the police stopped that car where the guy didn't have a seatbelt on, yeah, it seems trivial, but it was a legitimate stop, first of all. The guy should probably know that he wasn't wearing a seatbelt, and they just want to see who he is, see his ID. Usually they don't just say, yeah, we stopped you, but it's trivial, so go ahead. And when we watched it, somebody might be sitting at home with a glass of beer and looking at it and thinking, oh, gee, these cops, what are they doing there? You know, but the guy did shoot at them first. And what are the police supposed to do? You know, they don't know exactly how many guns this guy has, how much extra ammunition. It's the worst thing that could happen to a cop, where you're basically ambushed, but the guy's right there in front of you. And that's it. Thank you very much.
Thanks for the call, Nick. Debbie in Kane County.
Hi, good morning, and thank you for having me on. I wanted to give you a little quick history of what's happening at our Kane County board meetings. It's in reference to the illegal immigrants that are being brought in. In January, the Kane County board had a proclamation addressing the migrant crisis that was brought forward. And there was an 11-11 tie, and it was to stop having illegals come here, the cost, et cetera. And the chair would not break the tie. And then we went on
profile
a March
and courage. 21st. Who's the Kane County chairman?
Corrine Pirogue.
She's a Democrat.
You're exactly right.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So on March,
of course, she's a Democrat.
21st,
Kane County Democrat haven now, thanks
well,
to
we're,
surrender
we're
Republicans.
We're trying really hard. We're trying really hard to change that. But anyway, on March 21st at the Public Service Committee, board member Dave Young, who is a Republican, proposed a new proclamation to say Kane County will not allow illegals to vote. Now, why we have to do that? Your guess is as good as mine, but we know we do. And we're trying to head off future issues. So during the discussion, Ms. Silva, a Democrat, stated that she thought that the illegals should vote in school board elections because they have children at the school.
Mm-hmm.
But the,
yeah. Sure, of course.
I mean,
right. Perfect logic. I get one undeserved benefit, so like, give me another one. Right?
Exactly. So then, but regardless of her opinion, the proclamation did pass that they said out of the committee to say, yes, Kane County should not have illegal voting. And so the next step would be to go to the executive committee, and it did not appear on the agenda. And who gets to pick what's on the agenda? The chair. Yep. And so then we thought, well, she's just skipping because it's a proclamation. She's going to bring it up at the county board meeting, and it would be on that agenda, which happened this last Tuesday, April 9th. And it was not on the agenda. And before the public comment, the chair made it a statement saying that if anyone was going to speak, it's not on agenda, and this has been put to bed and is sleeping, and we're not going there anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, obviously, she does not want to have the vote, because it's an election year, to say no illegals can vote in Kane County elections. So I just – go ahead.
No, go ahead, Debbie.
I just wanted to say, I think anyone who wants to listen to these the meetings, I highly recommend it. We need to educate voters and understand that this is the chair. She's up for election, and this is her agenda, and it's her choice to what can be put on the agenda, even though it passed out of committee.
Thanks for the call, Debbie. Appreciate it. That's where Kane County's at. By the way, I saw a story about Wilmette. Wilmette saying, we've been able to handle the few migrants who got dropped off at the Wilmette train station that we didn't ship down to Chicago. They didn't quite say it in these words, but this is what they did. But like, if there's a real influx, you know, where we can't handle anymore. So Wilmette is full up. No more migrants in Wilmette. I disagree. I think that the Wilmette village government is underestimating, because this was said by the village manager. I think the Wilmette village government is underestimating the compassion of Wilmetians. And if the Republican Party wanted to be a Republican Party, then maybe they would be doing things like making sure that we test the outer limits of the compassion of our privileged communities. You know, it's nothing but privileged honkies in Wilmette.
Right.
And turn those migrants right back around if they get sent from Wilmette to Chicago and drop them off at Village Hall. Don't you? But, I mean, that's the sort of thing that requires an opposition party, which we don't have. Matt Southside.
Hey, good morning, Dan. Good morning, Amy. I want to first of all say that there's no way Dexter Reed bought his mother a Peloton. I didn't, and I'll tell you why, because I didn't see anybody on any videos running out during a smash and grab with a Peloton. The other thing I wanted to say was whenever somebody tells you, Dan, because I agree with you, that Sarah Huckabee would be an excellent choice for vice president, I think it's very probable. But whenever somebody says, I don't think she's ready or, you know, to be president on day one, all you got to do is say, I have two words for you, Kamala Harris.
Thanks for the call, Matt. Susan, Cedar Lake, Indiana.
Hi, Dan and Amy. Happy Friday. What do you get when you put Lorena Bobbitt, Tammy Faye, and O.J. Simpson in the same room?
What?
A butcher, a baker, and a license plate maker.
Oh.
All right. Thanks for the call, Susan. We will take additional O.J. jokes. We don't think that Norm Macdonald cornered the market.
Okay.
Bob and Wilmette, speaking of
Hey, good morning, Dan and Amy. Two things. Number one, Dan, I just very much enjoyed your little rant on the Wilmetians.
Yeah.
Being from Wilmette.
You guys have rum, right? I mean, there's a lot more love to give from Wilmette, isn't there?
Are you kidding me? Plenty. And what I'd suggest is when they get to the Wilmette train station, we have windowless panel vans waiting for them, and then we sprinkle them throughout the neighborhoods, well, specifically to the homes that have the hate has no home here signs,
exactly.
The BLM signs, and the signs that have that whole paragraph of we believe in science and all that crap. So those are the homes that they go to.
And you know what? If nobody's home, just help them break into the guest house and make themselves at home. Right? I mean, you know, I mean, look, you're not going to let them, you know, starve and freeze on the streets when it's 60 degrees out or whatever. I mean, so
no.
Again, I mean that, right? I mean, this is Wilmette we're talking about.
Right. And squatters have rights, right?
Precisely.
In all 50 states.
Precisely.
Believe it or not.
Tom Dart would absolutely sanction this.
Exactly. He'll give them puppies.
And number two, I'd like to introduce you and your listeners to a new socio-politico comedy Substack newsletter entitled Oh Well, Orwell, 40 Years Post 1984, The Time Has Never Been More Right to Poke Fun at the Left.
So, oh, very good.
Have at it.
All right.
The opening scene is a duck, a polar bear, and Greta Thunberg walking into a bar. And I'll leave it at that.
Oh, my God.
I love it.
Have a great weekend, everybody.
You
Thanks
too.
For the call, Bob. There's another comedy off-Broadway that is out. I wanted to bring this to people's attention. It's called Suffs. It's a Suffs, as in suffragettes.
Okay. Oh, thank you. Let me guess, are they wearing white?
It's produced by Hillary Clinton, so you know it's hip.
Oh, boy.
And here's a little portion of a little ditty that you'll be treated to if you get a couple of tickets to this off-Broadway Hillary Clinton production. Brought to you by the illicit cash she gobbled up from the Clinton Foundation from America's Enemies. This is Suffs. And then what happens is that all the men dressed as women burn their bras. Sort of like that's the crescendo.
Dear Lord. I'd rather tear my spleen out with a rusty spoon than watch that.
Bob in Rogers Park.
Yes, I have O.J. Simpson's email address. It's //escape.
Oh, my God. You guys are so bad.
That's Norm MacDonald quality there.
That's pretty good.
Pretty good. Staying on topic. The Irish Prime Minister who hails from Ogden Dunes, Indiana.
Oh, you know, O.J. Simpson was on trial, and the Judge Ito went around and said to the jurors, I've got good news and bad news. The good news is, you're all going to have a conjugal visit. The bad news is it's going to be with me.
Okay.
The second OJ.
Oh, there's more. Oh, good. Thank God.
Yeah. I got to get a laugh out of you. I can't go away without one. The OJ Simpson's liars, you know, his liars believed that they could get a hung jury for the man. But if it was a jury of his peers, it would have been a well-hung jury.
Don't we have a Governor Lizzo joke? J.B. Lizzo? Do we have any Governor J.B. Lizzo?
It hurts me to hear such foolery, Tom. It hurts me to hear such Tom. Oh, I'm so sad. If I can't hear Amy laugh once a week, it just, you know, it's a bad week.
Oh, okay. She's got a high bar. Is that all? And anything else, Prime Minister? Last call.
Yes, anything else.
I just love you guys from the Emerald Isle. We can't do enough without you. And we just love the two of you till death do us part.
Very good. Thank you, PM. Rich, Indian Head Park.
Good morning, Dan. Good morning, Amy. What I wanted to say is how pathetic is this administration of Biden? And they can send out a condolence to Simpson's family. When Lincoln Riley was murdered, brutally murdered, they said nothing. And only to say later that he shouldn't have called them an illegal because they should all be treated with dignity and respect. How pathetic and embarrassing is this guy? Thanks, and you guys have a nice weekend.
Thank you, Rich. Appreciate it. All right. Let's close it out with our friend Chuck from Delavan.
Hey, thanks for mentioning all my garage bands. Was he clairvoyant? And you too, Dan, privileged honky. Hey, the Pelicans, public service announcement. The Pelicans are back flying around in Delavan as they make their way to North Dakota. So if you want, get on the Lake Long tour boat and get out there and see them. The D-Light Duo is Sunday at the Tap Room from 2 to 5. And tonight, I'm going to the Two Thai Sister at 5:15 and get a bunch of Thai food, go to the 46 Bar, and then go see these two guys that flew in from Brazil. It's called the B2 Winds. And they play all kinds of music. The place is going to be great. You can still get tickets over to Bigfoot High School. You guys have a great weekend. Everybody get out and enjoy yourself.
Boy, even half as much as Chuck, and you'll really be enjoying yourself. That's quite an itinerary Chuck has this weekend.
Before you see it on TV, share it on Facebook, or read about it in the paper, hear it here first. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer.
Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.